Almighty and merciful God, from whom comes all counsel, wisdom, and understanding, we humbly ask you to guide and assist us in our deliberations and in our work. May all our efforts be directed to the welfare and good of our community and country. May we act honorably in pursuit of true justice for all our people, now and for the future, and for generations still to come. Amen.
Meeting of Parliament, Thursday, 17th of October 2013. 1. Oath of Allegiance. 2. Confirmation of Minutes. The minutes of the last meeting of Parliament, which was held on the 19th of September 2014.
May I find the minutes correct?
Three, communications in the chair. 4, petitions. 5, announcements. 6, papers to be laid. 7, reports of committees. Suspension of standing orders. The Honourable Richie Simpson.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to move under standing order 7.3 to suspend standing order 7.1 in order to proceed with a government bill.
Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
Bill. First and second reading. A bill for an act to strengthen the information gathering and cooperation powers of the Commission, established under the Financial Services Commission Act 2007, authorities appointed under a supervisory act, and persons who exercise such functions and all other related matters. The Honourable Minister for Financial Services and Gaming.
Mr. Speaker, I have long to move that a bill for an act to strengthen the information gathering and cooperation powers of the Commission, established under the Financial Services Commission of 2007, authorities appointed under the supervisory act, and persons who exercise such functions and all other related matters do at the first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to strengthen the information gathering and cooperation powers of the Commission established under the Financial Services Commission Act 2007, authorities appointed under the Supervisory Act, and persons who exercise such functions and all other related matters do at the first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Financial Services Information Gathering and Cooperation Act 2013.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill may be read a second time. Mr. Speaker, the government has strongly supported the application by the Financial Services Commission to become a signatory to the Multilateral Memorandum of Understanding concerning consultation and cooperation and the exchange of information, MMOU, of the International Organization of Security Commissions, known as IOSCO. IOSCO was established in 1983
and is acknowledged as national body that brings together the world's security regulators and is recognized as the global standard setter for the security sector. IOSCO develops, implements, and promotes adherence to internationally recognized standards for security regulation and is working intensively with the G20 and the Financial Stability Board on the Global Regulatory Forum agenda. IOSCO's membership regulates more than 95% of the world's securities market. Its members include over 120 securities regulators and 80 other securities market participants, as in, for example, stock exchanges, financial, regional, international organizations. IOSCO is the only international financial regulatory organization which includes all the major emerging market jurisdictions within its membership. I should emphasize that there are fully 97 signatories to the MMOU and includes all the advanced major economies, as well as international financial centers such as Bermuda, BDI, the Cayman Islands, Dubai, Guam, New Jersey, Hong Kong, and the Isle of Man. In order for the FSC to become a signatory to the MMOU, IOSCO has requested that certain changes be made to our legislation. After various rounds of discussion between the FSC and IOSCO, we and the FSC believe that this bill makes the necessary changes to ensure that the FSC, and thereby Gibraltar, can become a signatory to the IOSCO MMOU. I should note, however, that IOSCO will not give its definitive opinion on our legislation until it is actually commenced. It is possible, therefore, that despite our very best efforts, we will need to make changes to proposed legislation in the near term after its commencement. We expect, however, that any such changes would be in the nature of minor amendments. Mr. Speaker, the government has also taken the opportunity in this bill to take into account a number of suggestions from the Financial Services Commission in regard to the same subject matter as the IOSCO request, namely the strengthening and unifying of information gathering and cooperation powers of the FSC for its own regulatory and supervisory functions, and their consolidation of these powers in a single act upon eventual repeal of equivalent provisions in the Supervisory Act, while ensuring that safeguards are in place against potential abuses of power. I now turn to the Bill itself. In Part 1, Clause 2, Interpretation, the definitions of the existing Supervisory Act are retained, except that in Clause 2, the definition of relevant person is extended from the current definition under the Supervisory Act to include, in small f, any person who is or has been directly or indirectly involved in the transaction which the authority considers relevant to the pursuit of its obligations under this or any of the Supervisory Acts. In Part 2, Confidential Information and Documents, Clause 2.1 sets out the crucial principle that information obtained by the authority is defined in Clause 2, that is to say, primarily the Financial Services Commission, must treat the information it obtains confidentially. Like Clause 2.2, Clause 1 is modelled on Section 23 of the existing Financial Services Commission Act 2007. However, in Clause 2.2, several further exceptions to the duty of confidentiality are added, primarily in order to meet IOSCO's requirements. These are, in 3.2d, for a memorandum of understanding between the authority as defined in Clause 2, primarily the Financial Services Commission, and other authorities, an IOSCO requirement. In 3.2e, to permit disclosures to domestic authority listed in Schedule 1, effectively removing present restrictions on the FSC from speaking to itself with information obtained under one Supervisory Act in relation to information obtained by it under another Supervisory Act. In CTF, to permit disclosure to foreign authorities with functions corresponding to those of the authority as defined in Clause 2. In CTG, to clarify that disclosure for authority supervision is permitted. In CTHI and J, to permit the FSC to disclose information to liquidators and auditors of regulated firms, as well as to those responsible for ensuring compliance with company law. In Clause 4, Mr. Speaker, this clause is modelled on Section 54 of the current Financial Services Markets and Financial Instruments Act, and is an essential requirement of the IOSCO MMOU. One effect of this clause is that, for example, when a request for assistance is made from a non-EU authority that is party to an MOU with Gibraltar, the FSC could honour this request without running through a separate checklist of requirements to satisfy itself that the request is proper, as it would already been addressed prior to entering into an MOU. So, five, this course is effectively after the LNA requirement that the SSC and the relevant authority in Gibraltar have the express power to enter into cooperation agreements. And so, six, Mr. Speaker, the clause is derived from Section 33 of the Financial Services Investment and Financial Services Act and has been included to meet the LNA requirement that the power to require production of documents be extended to include requests for information. Clause 7 is derived from Section 33A of the Financial Services Investment and Financial Services Act. A similar provision already exists in some of the other supervisory acts. The government considers it useful for the FSC to require a steering conference report in any relevant area under supervision in a consistent and harmonised manner. Similarly, Mr. Speaker, in Clause 8, this clause is derived from Section 101 of the Financial Services Insurance Companies Act, and it's been included here as it does not exist in all supervisory acts with terms of the appointment of inspectors. This merit lies in allowing for focused investigations by suitably qualified individuals to report on the affairs of persons carrying on or who are believed to be carrying on or to have carried on irregulated activity. Clause 9 deals with people with the powers of inspectors, and I also require that inspectors to be allowed to examine individuals under oath, and this is reflected in Clause 9. Clause 10, Mr. Speaker, the first permits the authority to require the inspector make interim reports and a final report of his investigation and allows for copies of any such report to be forwarded to various persons and authorities, including the Ministry of Responsibility for Financial Services. The clause is taken from Section 103 of the Financial Services and Insurance Companies Act and is being included here as it does not exist in all of the existing supervisory acts. Clause 11, Mr. Speaker, relates to the duty to produce records. This clause places an obligation on the person who has been investigated by an inspector and on any other person whom an inspector examines to provide information, including documentation, to the inspector. The clause is taken from Section 104 of the Financial Services and Insurance Companies Act and is being included here so as to extend to all regulated activities. Part 5, Mr. Speaker, Clause 12. Expressly enable the authority to cooperate with other authorities which exercise supervisory or regulatory responsibility over a relevant person. This power already exists under Section 60 of the Financial Services Banking Act. The clause extends this power across all regulated activities and thereby to all relevant regulators, including security regulators, as required by the NMAU of IOSCA. Clause 13. This clause has been included because the OSCE NMAU makes specific provisions for circumstances where a recipient authority may refuse to cooperate. The clause is drawn directly from paragraph 60 of the NMAU. This is clause 14 deals with offences and punishes willfully making statements or providing information known to be untrue in material respect. The clause is drawn from section 82.6 of the Financial Services Banking Act and has been included so that it can be applied across all of the supervisory acts. Clause 15, Mr. Speaker, has been included to ensure that unauthorized disclosures of information are punishable with sanctions, including imprisonment and fines. The clause is drawn from Section 16 of the Financial Services Commission Act. Clause 16, Mr. Speaker, punishes refusal to supply information or to cooperate with the authority with an accelerating fine. The clause is drawn from Section 104 of the Financial Services and Insurance Companies Act, except for subclause 3, which is taken from Section 22B of the Crime, Money Laundering and Proceeds Act on the protection of legal privilege. Clause 16, Mr. Speaker, deals with appeals to the Supreme Court and expects to provide the appeals from the decision of the SSC to the Supreme Court. This has been included as an important check on the Financial Services Commission's powers and is taken from Section 104 of the Financial Services and Insurance Companies Act. Clause 18, Mr. Speaker, sets out the Supreme Court's options once an appeal is lodged and is also taken from Section 104 of the Financial Services and Insurance Companies Act. Mr. Speaker, Clause 19 ensures that the authority's power to sell information cannot be impeded if that information is obtained under one of the supervisory acts and deals with the transitional provisions. Clause 20, Mr. Speaker, deals with consequential amendments. This clause repealed the confidentiality section of the Financial Services Commission Act 2007, so as to ensure that clause 3 of the bill, which is also compliant, is the sole relevant provision on confidentiality across the Supervisory Act. And it's also mentioned that it is our intention to repeal further sections of the Supervisory Act so that they do not run in parallel with the provisions of this proposed bill. However, we thought it prudent not to make these appeals for the time being, given the aforementioned possibility that changes based on our feedback may need to be made to the Act after the time commenced. Finally, I shall be putting the following two minor amendments of the committee form. In clause 3.2, the word everybody should in fact read two separate words separated by a space, it being the intention in 3.2 to refer to physical persons and collective entities. And certainly, Mr. Speaker, in clause 4.4d, the letter O in the word authority ought to be capitalized as authority as the case is throughout the entire clause. Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to my honourable friends together who I have discussed and consulted with on the bill, and we have these two amendments that I've been reading come as a result of his intervention. I'm grateful to him for that and his cooperation. I'm also grateful to the Financial Services Commission for their work in getting this bill to the House this morning. I commend the bill to the House.
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of this bill? The honourable Mr. President,
Mr. Speaker, yes, it is my honour and privilege to rise today to speak on the merits of the bill. And I would like to take the opportunity first of thanking the Honourable Minister and his team for their diligence in dealing with the various inquiries and issues that arose when we discussed the bill on a number of occasions before today. I would also like to congratulate the Minister on his maiden speech since being returned to this House on the 4th of July. Today, the opposition will not, Mr. Speaker, be opposing the bill. I've best raised the matter of the vocal status as a non-signatory to our Oxford MMOU publicly in March of this year, highlighting the fact that the act of signing up to the multilateral memorandum of understanding was a very important measure for the vocal status take. It was the then GSP government in 2009 that signalled the vocal commitment to sign up to the memorandum, and the Honourable Mr. Legutti, who was at the time responsible for financial services, rightly pointed out that the GSP did not bring relevant legislation to this House before December 2011. Draft legislation post the election was then circulated to the then leader of the opposition, Sir Peter Caruana, for comment. It was opposition then, as it is today, that in the absence of comments, Mr. Speaker, it was the now government's responsibility to actively manage the timetable in this regard to ensure a timely sign-up to the MMOU. At the time, Mr. Speaker, the government also issued a statement saying, and I quote, "It is also important to note that there is presently no stock exchange in Gibraltar on which securities are listed. This is therefore not an issue that is of any pressing practical importance in that respect. Indeed, it is as important in practice as not having complied with a protocol on commercial fishing in rivers or industrial scale farming, given that there are no such activities in Gibraltar." End quote. It turned out, Mr. Speaker, that as we had said at the time, the MMOU scope was wider than that. More specifically, we had explained in our own press releases, and I quote, that the MMOU's reaches, as the government should be aware of, far wider than the government lets on. Indeed, a cursory review of the MMOU and the organization's objectives makes it patently clear that the majority of its work is not concerned with stock exchanges, but with financial products, which are a key component of the financial services industry in Gibraltar. End quote. In May, Mr. Speaker, I asked the then Minister for Financial Services, General Mr. Legutti, whether the government would be in a position to pass the legislation soon. I was assured that a command paper would be issued within a matter of weeks, which command paper would indeed be issued on the 14th of June of this year. This allowed for a period of 2 weeks of consultation. I further understand that there was no response to the command paper, and I am informed that the FSC, as part of its value proposition in this process, requested a number of changes to the command paper draft, one of them being the addition of sub-clause F to clause 2, which the Honourable Minister had alluded to in his address this morning. Additionally, I have been given to understand by a very helpful team that I've worked with the Honourable Minister on the floor that the other significant difference between the command paper and the bill before the House is the deletion of a comprehensive list of consequential amendments, which is part of the original draft of the command paper. The only consequential amendment that remains in the bill today is the deletion of Section 23 of the Financial Services Commission Act 2007, which will now practically word for word be law under Section 3 of the bill. amendments missing from this bill, I am satisfied, following a discussion with the Honourable Minister, that from a practical perspective, it is desirable to attempt to be doubled when there is certainty in respect of Gibraltar's approval of the signature of the IFO and MOU. In the time between publication of the command paper on the 14th of June and the publication of the film, Mr. Speaker, which was on the 29th of August, the financial services industry saw some further development. Those were the publication by the European Securities and Markets Authority of the guidelines for the model MOU concerning consultation, cooperation, and exchange of information related to the supervision of the Alternative Investment Fund Managers Directive entity, and importantly, 4 days later, the signing of regulations transposing that directive into local law. The ESMA guidelines set up the model for the memorandum understanding between the EU and non-EU supervisory authorities for the purposes of achieving the appropriate supervision cooperation agreements required by the directive, a directive which, as I just explained, was implemented into Gibraltar mere 4 days after the publication of the guidelines. Those guidelines further explain, and I quote, that the ESMA MOU should be complementary to the IOSCO MOU concerning consultation and cooperation and the exchange of information in 2003, revised in 2005. This implies that in order for it to be considered that both the European competent authorities and the non-EU supervisory authorities have cooperation agreements in place as required by the directive, both authorities should be signatories to both the MOU set out in the guidelines and the multilateral memorandum of understanding of IOSCO. Mr. Speaker, the book is not currently on the list of EU competent authorities, and the passage of this bill into law is critical to the book's inclusion in it. It will only be after Gibraltar signs up to the IOSCO MOU that this limitation will be lifted and that Gibraltar will be able to fully offer itself as the open jurisdiction that is fully open to the new and very exciting opportunity that this represents for the local funds industry. Turning to the substance of the Act, the Honourable Minister has very comprehensively gone through all the provisions, and there is nothing that I can add that he has not already dealt with. To conclude, therefore, while members on this side of the House making sure that it would have been desirable for this matter to have been considered some time ago, we are all keen to see this legislation make its way into the statute books, and crucially, in so doing, are hopeful that our support for the bill may see Gibraltar's inclusion on the list of IOSCO MOU signatories without delay.
I now put a question. It is that a bill for an act to strengthen the information gathering and cooperation powers of the Commission, established under the Financial Services Commission Act 2007, authorities appointed under the Supervisory Act, on persons who exercise such functions and all other related matters, be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Financial Services Information Gathering and Cooperation Act 2013.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to give notice to the committee stating third reading of the bill be taken today if all honourable members agree.
If all honourable members agree, that the committee states and third reading of the bill be taken now.
Committee stage and third reading, the honourable achievement.
I have the honour to move that the House should resolve itself into committee to consider the following bill called by clause, namely the Financial Services Information Gathering and Cooperation Bill 2013. A bill
for an act to strengthen the information gathering and cooperation powers of the Commission, established under the Financial Services Commission Act 2007, authorities appointed under a supervisory act, and persons who exercise such functions and all other related matters. Clause 1.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 2.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 3.
Mr. Speaker. Mr. Chairman, In question 2, the word everybody is on line 3 should be replaced by the two words everybody.
All those in favour? Those against? Amendment carried. Clause C as amended stands part of the bill.
Clause 4.
This is now clause 4.4d. The word authority should be capitalised with a capital A.
That amendment agreed to?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Clause 4, as amended, stand part of the bill.
Clause 5,
part of the bill.
Clause 6,
stand part of the bill.
Clause 7,
stand part of the bill.
Clause 8,
stand part of the bill.
Clause 9,
stand part of the bill.
Clause 10.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause.
Stand part of the bill. 11. Clause 11. Clause 11. Stand part of the bill.
Clause 12.
Clause 12. Stand part of the bill.
Clause 13.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 14.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 15.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 60.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 70.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 19.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 20.
Stand part of the bill.
Schedule.
Stand part of the bill.
A long time.
Stand part of the bill.
The Honourable Richardson.
Mr. Speaker, I have long to report that the Financial Services Information Gathering and Cooperation Bill 2013 has been considered in committee and agreed with some amendments, and I now move that it be read a third time and done.
I now put a question, which is that the Financial Services Information Gathering and Cooperation Bill 2013 be read a third time and passed. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
Eight answers to all questions. Question 544 of 2013, the Honourable D.J. Buffini.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Tourism provide details of the numbers of private cars which have visited the Upper Rock Nature Reserve, broken down on a monthly basis since the assumed visit?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Commercial Affairs, Public Transport and the Port.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. And I'll hand over to the Honourable Gentleman and schedule with information and request. Why have I received the schedule, and can I ask the Honourable Minister why before when I talked about administrative issues, like that, table 2 and everything. So the C11 set out in the Gibraltar Government website, which details the total number of upper rock nature reserve visited by month and year, and in June of this year, 2013. Can you give an explanation as to why it hasn't been updated for the last 5 or 6 months? I think, Mr. Speaker, the only way we want to do that is to have to find out for. Speaker, the reason why it's raised and it comes to my notice is precisely because I was in some research in relation to the testing that I just told. Just find it surprising that the information isn't contained in that schedule, and it's rather outdated. But if I can just have a second to review the schedule, I'd be great. Not surprising, in fact, that the figures that one of the comparative exercise between last year 12-13 and the current year 13-14, there is a reduction of about 50%. In August, particularly in August and September, the other months are more or less the same. Does the Minister have any concerns in relation to that, and does he have any comments in relation to those figures?
Well, Mr. Speaker, of course, any decrease in numbers of claimants of upper rock is not welcome news, and I'm sure that the other gentlemen will be sure that they will have a retake review. But before I take any concern of this specific, I would do so if there was a consistent pattern over perhaps 3 to 6 months, as opposed to, as we have correctly identified, just 2 months.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, clearly those 2 months are ordinarily the biggest. In fact, one does an analysis of those same figures for last year, as you would expect, precisely because it's the summer season, you see a massive increase. And it must be very worrying indeed from the government's perspective, certainly from my perspective, and certainly not surprised, basically, that the figures could be so far reduced from last year. But in terms of the income which is being included in government coffers, that must have a significant effect. So the only point I make is that although he said that he's reserving comments until there's a longer period of time and can make an analysis, we can already make an analysis based on the fact that we are dealing with a business traditionally, as one would expect, the business period of time in terms of visitor arrivals at the Upper Rock.
Well, Mr. Speaker, in respect to the purpose of this question, it says it would make a significant impact on the revenue stream of the government. It will make an impact to the extent that they've been reduced, no more and no less. And I can just calculate and keep them in the same way that I can. It must be very speaker, so that the public is not alarmed, and I'm not saying that the Honourable Gentleman is going to be alarmed, that his question is specifically cast in terms of the numbers of private cars. We're not talking about people walking up the Upper Rock or tour operators, which of course is the main way in which people go to the Upper Rock.
Speaker, I obviously can't make a call. I haven't asked that specific question. And but I refer the Honourable Minister to the point I made earlier in terms of the information that is ordinarily provided on the government website and isn't available from during that year. I look forward to seeing that information posted so I can make that analysis and indeed whether there has been a reduction in the nature of reserve visitors over the last year. I would expect that one would also see a dent in road arrivals, because obviously people also travel in cars. There are less cars going out, one would have thought there are also less people within the nature of the road. But at this stage, I think it's just suffered little until we have the precise figures in relation to this arrivals. But I'm grateful for the Honourable Minister for this information here.
Question 546,
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Minister has raised the question of nature reserve visitors and tour operators by suggesting that these figures may not be reflective of the overall
to meet with visitors and tour operators, and does he know whether they go up or down, or is it just a comment? In other words, well, let's wait until we see what figures there are in the future in relation, what the figures show in the future in relation to these two areas.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I said when answering to the process with the question of the honourable gentleman to the scene, the question was asked specifically in relation to private cars, and that's what I was trying to say that in terms of the overall picture, but we need to consider as well for the transport operators. I remember reading on one side an answer given by the honourable Mr. Speaker Cavallo when numbers were down in one particular year. And he said that when numbers were down in terms of vehicular traffic in the Upper Rock, the positive flip side to that was that there was less congestion and therefore perhaps a lot more presence. Can the Honourable Gentleman perhaps postulate a reason why these are down for the months of August and September?
The Honourable Gentleman generally knows the reason for that, and that is because our neighbour to the north decided recently to harass and bully Little Gibraltar, and so it's been placed the most inhumane disproportionate check on the border, which clearly had an impact on the number of tourists coming in.
Mr. Speaker, perhaps can you confirm within Cabinet when all this was discussed that the Honourable Gentleman told the Chief Minister the next time that he threw concrete blocks into the
Elevator?
No. I'm not going to allow the Leader of the Opposition under the guise of this type of question to hold a debate on the resistance at the frontier.
Question.
Speaker, the one, I think, relevant to this point that arises from the answer that he has just given to the Honourable Leader of the Opposition, is, you know, whether when answering the question, I didn't say this specifically, when researching the answer to the question that I posed in relation to private vehicle traffic, where that ought not to put in any inquiry in relation to whether there has been a consequential decrease in the number of visitors to the Upper Rock. And that's the question I posed, and he simply said, look, I don't know. And that is his answer on the record, but I really must insist whether he has any information available to him, any indication at least, as to whether there has been a consequential decrease in the number of visitors to the Upper Rock Nations. But I would actually, from my personal perspective, the important points which arises from the reply he's just given to the Honourable Leader of the Opposition.
Mr. Speaker, once again, the question is cast in very specific terms. As I'm sure that he understands, I do keep, not just myself, but of course, the Water Tourist Board and people in the Ministry, we do keep an ongoing review of the number of visitors that come to Gibraltar. For those visitors that come to Gibraltar, do so walking into Gibraltar, private vehicles, and tour operators. And of course, we also have the cruise liner passengers that disembark and also go to the Upper Rock. So I'm more than happy to engage in answering questions, in answering this question, but I would rather we do it scientifically and forensically rather than on an overall memory exercise that we have to do now, rather than being able to go through the figures and bring them to them in this type of encounter, as I've mentioned, for the wishes on that information.
Mr. Speaker, is he telling the House that he has no indication whatsoever whether the figures of this are going up, down, or more or less the same, whether there's anything, whether there's a worrying trend or something that one ought not to be concerned about, precisely because of the other channels of sources of visitor arrivals if it comes to from the various points that he has mentioned? Can he clarify that position for me?
Mr. Speaker, yes, I have already clarified this position to the Honourable Gentleman.
I told him that his own analysis, with which I agree, was that there were two months, August and September, where the numbers were down. And I've already replied to him that in order for me to be able to say whether I am wary about whether there is a steady decrease or there was a two-month anomaly, I would like to see figures for a theme extending more than 2 months, and surely in some statistics and numbers, we would have to take an annual view, but at least a six-month view, and not on the basis of 2 months, would have been close to decide whether or not that would have an impact on the rest of the year. And I also told them that I'm more than happy to engage them in answering these questions on the other modes of entering the water, but rather than doing on an exercise based on my recollection of my discussion with my officials, when we've considered the statistics and with working for transport operators, etc., they don't know properly by giving a list of the question, would be more than happy to provide back to them and my view of those statistics, but over an annualized period rather than based on a 2 month period, which I'm sure you'll agree with me, would give a speedy right.
It is the Minister for Tourism who has referred us to the despicable behaviour of the Spanish government in the manner that it has behaved at the start yesterday. But then the younger leader of the opposition has condemned the behaviour by the Spanish government, and this party clearly condemns that behaviour as a collective. But the Speaker clearly then, he must admit that this can be the result of a 2 month anomaly. I mean, if he is citing what is happening at the center, which must be the obvious reason why there is such a huge reduction in the number of vehicular traffic accessing the other rock, and clearly, given that the borrowing one of the international word total at the frontier continues relentlessly, then clearly one would expect that will not be an anomaly and that will continue for many months to come, it seems. That does not accept that analysis and the premise of the argument that I have just put with you. Because this is bordering on the politically absurd. I've already told the Honourable Gentleman that I refuse to be drawn into making a hypothesis on the numbers, on the number of people that will be coming into Gibraltar for the rest of the year, on his own analysis, which was to me, and Christopher Rose was out not just 7 minutes ago, that the number of visitors were down in private cars in September and August. And note also in the preface to the question that the other months were more or less where they were meant to be. So if the other months were more or less where they were meant to be, and the only decrease relates to August and September, then I suggest to him that we wait until we have the full picture, which will be taken into account the full year, and then we can talk about the facts, the statistics, rather than me hypothesizing and speculating as to whether or not there will continue to be in August and September, or whether it will be in January, February, March, and April, which are more or less the same as the year before.
Question 546, the Honourable Dean James of Seymour.
Can the Minister for Tourism advise whether there has been any further development, whether by way of a further expression of interest or otherwise, in relation to the development of the Leicester Hotel at Devil's Island?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Commercial Affairs, Public Transport and the Port.
I think we have missed the question.
No,
it's 545.
No, we haven't. It's 546. 545 is going to be answered by the Minister. Mm-hmm. All right.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. Simon Lester of Leicester Hotels came to see me on Friday the 3rd of May of this year to update me on the project. Mr. Lester subsequently attended a meeting of the UK GTA in London in June of 2013 as an observer. He gave a brief update on the project of this meeting. The GTB and I have had further email correspondence with Mr. Lester. All I can say at the moment is that it is the present intention of Mr. Lester to proceed. My first reaction is to welcome them on the basis of the last occasion I asked in relation to this particular hotel was in September of 2012, more than a year ago. And you know, the reply was the Honourable the Minister of Health, the local thing. He has the new expression, well, may I have a guy around. The reply from the Honourable Minister was that, you know, pretty much the thing had died a death because he had failed to pay him the application fee for planning permission, and then both the other legal opposition and myself quizzed him as to whether, you know, whether he was making any further inquiries, given that this was potentially an important investment in Gibraltar. This is a hotel which I think the original plan was to build it at Gibraltar Road. What I can tell the Honourable the Minister is that I do welcome the news and the fact that there is, you know, a further expression of interest by the potential investor, and that the government is lending him a friendly ear and assistance in that regard. Can he tell you, I don't know, whether there is any specific progress, you know, has the application been paid for planning permission? You know, what further information, what further particulars can you give me, if I can at least perhaps even have a timeline as to when it is expected that the hotel will go up, whether there is anything which will delay or even prevent the proceeding of this particular project.
Mr. Speaker, on the point of clarification and whether I don't have the answer to expect, which I normally do, I'm quite sure being said that the matter of digest, what I told you on the gentleman and the lady at the time, was that Mr. Lester had not paid the application fee, and that I had made inquiries and that was actually the petition, but I did not suggest as a result of that they were digest, but rather the matter had not been progressed by the potential developer. Since the answer to the side, there were developments by the developer, and I've set them out in the answer to his original question. The matter is very much in the hands of the developer. He knows the support of the B2B and I are willing to give him in the event that we were to start the process. We spoke about marketing opportunities, marketing channels, and how the developer is forced to be able to be able to market the project once it starts. And when it starts, is a matter entirely for him. He did relate to me the reasons in a private meeting, which are of course entirely confidential, but I'm sure that he will know that I am just as eager to do, as are everyone on this side of the fence, for there to be an increase in Vector of the quality that Mr. Vector proposes to do. So as soon as it starts, we will welcome the proposal and the project to open end. I will also receive marketing support from the board association.
Mr. Speaker, this is all based on information that I've received. Does the Honourable, or can the Honourable the Minister for Tourism advise whether there is any linkage between this potential project and the inside development?
The only way to answer that question is not that I am aware. When we spoke on the 3rd of June or the day that I gave him, there was no mention at all of discussing the respect of the site. We spoke of a very specific plot of land, which is the same plot of land that was determined when they were in government.
Question 547, the Honourable DJ Buffini.
So this is question number 702 of 2012. Can the Minister for Tourism advise whether any progress has been made in relation to the possible development of a new cruise terminal?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Commercial Affairs, Public Transport and the Port.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. As I stated in answer to question number 702 of 2012, and after consultation with the local cruise agent and senior executives of cruise companies, I can assure the fact that they are perfectly satisfied with the current facilities at the cruise terminal, and that therefore money would be better spent elsewhere.
May I take the opportunity to lend the House, Mr. Speaker, that existing Keys Terminal was a project started by the GCC government and inaugurated by the GCC when in office. Therefore, Mr. Speaker, it gives me great pleasure to say that there are currently no plans to build a new Keys Minor Terminal.
Is always an interesting lesson in history, or an interesting lesson in history. Yeah, well, Mr. Speaker, as I understand the answer, the government has decided not to proceed in relation to the question is specifically the possible development of the new cruise terminal. The basic four assets on the grounds of consultation that have been undertaken by his department, no doubt. Now, the question is this, because in their manifesto, GCC Liberals promised that they would be providing, and I quote, improved terminal facilities. So, in the context of my question, which goes with possible development in relation to the terminal, my question is, you know, how are they going to make that particular manifesto commitment good? And in a spirit of constructiveness, can I tell them that from the little I know of the cruise liner industry, I am advised that, and I think it was mentioned in the manifesto itself, which is a page which I assume that the Honourable Minister had a hand in drafting, that the industry is looking in the future at the hop-on, hop-off facility. And that, as I understand it, the cruise liner terminal as it stands at the moment is not equipped to provide that facility. So can the Minister provide any information in relation to that?
Mr. Speaker, in respect of the fund of the preface of this supplementary question, the consultation was done by myself and myself. So I spoke personally to the cruise liner executives in Miami in the UK and also locally. And in fact, I think one of the first emails I received here in office was an email from, I would say, the biggest cruise local agent in Gibraltar, setting out to me in an enumerated paragraph why money should not be spent on the new cruise liner terminal. And that advice was, in fact, echoed by everyone else that I met. And before I say yes to my question, that it might explain £80,000 and it would be the amount to spend, or was it $3.8 million rather? It was $3.8 million. Yes, it was $3.8 million because it's just underneath the threshold tender for an EU tendering process. Yes, it was $3.8 million. It was $3.8 million for, and it certainly was the case that $3.8 million could be much better spent differently. It seems like to be amalgamating this question and another one as to the hop-on-hop-off issue. That has been advised by the Honourable Chief Minister and Ministry since 1998. Which has been a live one to start by the local operators and etc. And in respect of the last supplementary question to get into, in respect of the manifesto commitment on the cruise liner terminal, that we would improve the liner terminal. We have done already some work, as I'm sure that I also mentioned in the budget address. We have attended to creating a new canteen within the cruise liner terminal building. We've also better prepared existing surfaces. We've painted the walls at the terminal. We've removed the humidity that was there. And we're also considering whether there is any use to the distant part of the building which is under sand.
Question 548, the Honourable DJ Athena.
Can
Can the Minister for Tourism provide a detailed breakdown of the expenditure described as, quote, market information on conferences, unquote, in her person, of the estimates booked under tourism?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Financial Affairs, Public Transport and Report.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I will be delighted to hand over to the Honourable Gentleman a schedule with information if he were to supply to me the year to which he refers. Speaker, when I phrase the question to the Honourable and have a particular year in mind, I was referring to the budget book and I'll tell you what was the cause of concern in my mind. There was an actual expenditure of £27,261 for 11-12, and then an estimated figure with a forecast item for 12-13 of £45,000 in each column. And then obviously for this budget year, the Honourable Minister's budget in relation to that particular item, another £45,000. So really what I wanted was why an explanation as to why he considered that that there was such an increase from £27,000 to £35,000.
So, Mr. Speaker, are we talking about 2012-2013 or 2013-2014?
Yes, it's obvious from the explanation that I've given, Mr. Speaker, that the Honourable Minister's interpretation of what I've just told him is correct. 12-13.
So, Mr. Speaker, then, if the Honourable Gentleman could take me once again to the particular item that he wants to question me on, I will do my best to assist him.
It's clear on the face of the question. It's head 30. As I was referring to the wrong one, it's actually head 30. The reason being that there were two questions posed in almost exactly the same terms, which deal with the tourism head and also the port and shipping. The one I referred to, the figures I gave him earlier were wrong. They referred to the port and shipping head, while the figure related to tourism are there, except page 104 of the budget book. And it's head 30, subhead 3. It's a description, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Minister is asking for a description. It's marketing, promotion, conferences, and then it's sort of subdivided into A, Gibraltar Tourist Board, and B, London Office. I'm in fact more interested in the Gibraltar Tourist Board figure. And I do apologise if the question wasn't asked in a particular manner as you would have liked for him to provide me with information. I'm not sure whether he has information there available, then it's a matter which can be stood down for either to write to me during the course of the next month, or I can indeed pose the question again at the next meeting.
Mr. Speaker, I have no wish to listen to another gentleman whether he's been able to clarify the scope of the question on the year. Question 549, the Honourable D.J. Bassini.
Speaker, this question is has a question particularly for the Honourable the Minister to answer. Based on question number 94 of 2013, can the Minister for the Port advise whether there have been any developments in relation to the construction of the 700-berth small boat marina, and if so, what these are?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Commercial Affairs, Public Transport and the Port.
Mr. Speaker, I'm delighted that the Honourable Gentleman should feel so comfortable in trying to make light of the fact that he forgot to state in the question the year to which he refers, and if they have the time to try to make a sign of it when he rises, rather than to silently forget the fact that he asked a question to which one could not know the answer because of the year was not cited. Be that as it may, Mr. Speaker, The construction of the 700 berth small boat marina is going out to public tender in accordance with a public finance open brackets controlling order close brackets Act 1977, procurement open brackets public contract close brackets regulations 2012, sufficient particularity to them, Mr. Speaker, and the tender notice have already been issued.
I think the question was pretty clear in the face of the budget book, and the Honourable Minister knows that wherever he has any doubts in relation to any questions that are going to pose, he normally picks up the phone and asks you. But clearly, he wanted to have his day in Parliament and to embarrass me. So be it. Mr. Speaker, in fact, on a question which I'm sure he could have answered just to pick up the phone, he wanted to answer it, particularly which, in my view, were clear in its face. But, Mr. Speaker, in relation to the 700 berth small boat marina, is the government so confident that it will be able to complete the project within the 3 years of this parliament? Because they are very, the Honourable Member for the Justice is obviously very excited about this particular project, no doubt because he has a very close involvement with it. But does he remain confident that he will be able to complete this project within the 2 years of this parliament? Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman knows that I hold in very high esteem, and therefore it's hard for me to say these things, but in respect of the last question, he's embarrassed himself. He didn't need me to embarrass him by forgetting the authority. And we're not too confidential here. Speaker, the Honourable the Minister gave a very technical reply to the question that I posed. I would simply remind him of what he told his house in February of this year in relation to the project when I posed the question. He had told me that plans had been drawn up for the small boat marina. He said that the project was at the technical assessment phase in terms of analysing a road study and commissioning geotechnical surveys, etc. surveys. The Environmental Safety Commission, the appropriate EIA, the Management Navigation Assessment Phase. Can you give me any particular progress that has been made from February to date? Mr. Speaker, yes, the Honourable Gentleman refers to Question Number 94 of 2013, where I do set out the various studies and surveys that have been conducted, that obviously have now been carried out, which allows us to complete the tender system. Does he at this stage have an estimate of the cost of the project? This has come up on a number of occasions, in particular, when we are dealing with something that's going to go out to public procurement. At the estimate stage, the government is not going to give that information across the floor of the House or put it in the public domain, because of course that could affect the competitiveness of the tender process and the value that the taxpayer gets for its money. I think the Honourable Gentleman will understand that. But once the tender is awarded, it is awarded in a particular amount, and that amount is disclosed. That we're in the middle of the tender process, and therefore it wouldn't be appropriate to provide that detail.
Question 550, the Honourable D.J. Dean.
Can the Minister for the Port provide a... Well, this is the question which arises at the same point, where the Minister has asked to get a particular, so I'll tweak that question the same manner as I've done question 548, Mr. Speaker.
Could you have a moment?
Can the Minister for the Port provide a detailed breakdown of the expenses incurred under the, quote, marketing and official visits, unquote, head in head 29 of the estimate book?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Commercial Affairs, Public Transport and the Port.
Mr. Speaker, must I also read my answer, or can I just agree across the board that I have to send information to the Finance Minister? Well, without any animus whatsoever to restart the debate we had 2 questions ago,
I would be delighted to hand over to the Honourable Gentleman and serve you with information and specifies the year to which he says.
Question 551, the Honourable S. M. Sierra.
Mr. Speaker, can the Honourable Minister for Transport provide this House with an update in respect of the city urban bicycle rental facility?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Commercial Affairs, Public Transport and Report.
Mr. Speaker, the position with the Jibby Bike Urban Bicycle Rent Facility remains as set out in Answer to Questions 927 of last year and 89 and 91 of this year. The House is for the moment, Mr. Speaker, that notwithstanding the best endeavours of the Water Bike Company and my Ministry to reach an amicable resolution with My Bike Station Limited to resolve the various problems set out in Answer to Previous Questions, it became clear that an impasse had been reached. Her Majesty's Government of Gibraltar therefore instigated court proceedings and Supreme Court of Gibraltar against my bike station on the 27th of July of this year. Furthermore, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman opposite has been kept apprised by me of developments on confidential terms.
I am grateful to the Honourable Minister for his answer in the House this morning and certainly, as you will appreciate already, grateful for the opportunities that he has given me to discuss this matter with the Council of State and the information that he has provided me over the month. I've brought this matter to light once more in your House, Mr. Speaker, in order to effectively appraise the public and those users of the service, I suspect in declining numbers, who had expressed concern at what appears to be the unrelenting and inevitable loss of a service that they have come to rely upon over months and years, I think it is now. I would ask the Honourable Minister whether, and we haven't asked these questions specifically, so that if he doesn't have the information, then certainly I will ask in future sessions. Is he able to say how many of the bikes that were within the system continue to be available today?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I think first of all, 135 remain working.
Five.
As the Honourable Gentleman knows, the bike can install with a particular chip that was required for the system to operate. And unfortunately, because of the problems that we've had with the supplier, we've been unable to fix the bike. The Honourable Gentleman knows, given our confidential briefing, that we really have tried to resolve the issue with the existing supplier. It certainly was the last resort to have to start proceedings, but representing the taxpayer, I felt that we have not been provided the service to the previous administration contracted, and we saw that there was no other choice to start court proceedings.
Mr. Speaker, would the Honourable Minister say in this House whether the government is exploring options for an alternative urban bicycle rental facility, and if they are, at what stage these explorations might be?
Mr. Speaker, I know that the Honourable Gentleman asked me in a question across the floor of the House, but I know that he knows he's opposed them, so we are actively pursuing different options with companies outside of Gibraltar, obviously, because there is no resident expertise. With one particular potential operator, I would say that we are quite advanced in that they should be in a position of forwarding to me if they haven't done so today, this morning or yesterday, a quote for an entirely new urban bike.
I'm grateful to the Minister for that, to their answer, and certainly that would imply, and I won't ask him, simply because it is almost too obvious, that by that reply, the government appears committed to replacing the urban bicycle rental scheme at some point during this term, given the state of play with these new potential suppliers. And I will await with some excitement news of development in that regard. I do have one final question to ask the Honourable Minister, and that is, would the Minister concur that, and again, with hindsight, it's very easy to assess these matters in the way that I'm going to,
Would the minister concur that it might perhaps have been in the face of a deteriorating system and the difficulties that were being experienced, would it have been perhaps better to take the initiative and suspend the service in a manner that might not, that whilst inconvenient, would not have run the risk, as I suspect it may well have, of putting users off the concept generally, killing it rather than letting it die a death? Did the minister not concur with that observation?
Well, Mr. Speaker, first of all, to answer the preface to the supplementary, he says that the government appears to be committed to replace the existing scheme with a new scheme. But I think it's fair to say that that forms part and parcel of the integrated sustainable transport and traffic plan. And one of the questions that have been asked in respect not just the government department, but of course the studies that have been conducted on households and on the streets, are whether people would use bicycles and other transport to go to work or for other use. And that is certainly a factor in that. I think it's no secret to say that bicycles, the use of bicycles, are welcome. And of course, this is the reason why, given that the potential we find in that the integrated policy will be that the use of bicycles should be advocated like walking and not in the car to go to work, for instance. We are already looking that if that be the conclusion, we will have a supplier in such a level to come to Walter and to get the new rental facility. I see whether we should have suspended the scheme rather than let it die there. When unfortunately that has been only patient, there are only 5 bicycles, but it's not there yet. There's an opportunity to be by scheme that work with the Walter Bus Company. And the reason why the system was not cancelled was because, perhaps naively of me, I thought at different junctures that we were close to coming to an agreement that would have enabled us to fix the bike, go from 5 or 12 at a time or 22 to 30 and have an operating effective system which would have resumed. That is why it was introduced.
Speaking of facts, I think the Honourable the Minister of Recall, when I had my meeting and learned from the responsibility for transport, I did raise questions in relation to the Jibby Bike scheme. And in fact, I think the way that we left it last year was that there were broadly two issues which had to be resolved. I recall that one of them were contractual in nature, and the other one I can't remember at this stage. But then when I asked the question, I was told that both those broad issues had been resolved and that we were sort of now in the process of seeing the scheme developing and flourishing. So I'm very glad for his last reply. But can I ask, given that the relationship with the current previous supplier and the government is now no longer there, can I ask what the nature of those proceedings are?
Speaker. In respect to the preface to the supplementary, he is in fact referring to question 97 of last year, where I do in fact say that the government had identified the problem, that the method supplier hasn't been resolved, and I even went further and said that it is expected the remaining bike stations would be in place in the next few months. So in fact, the recollection is absolutely correct. We came to the point where we thought that everything had been resolved and it was just a question of bringing the bike stations to Gibraltar. As to the nature of the proceedings, I have briefed his honourable and learned friend in confidence. I have no problem doing the same with him, but I think that it's not appropriate to go into the nature or the detail of proceedings across the Silver House. The matter being from previously, but as I said, it does not stop me from further briefing members of the if they wish to have further details. In the same way, that I was more than happy to do so with Mr. Fiona.
Yeah. But, Mr. Speaker, the same thing, and I quite understand the desire and the successful on this side that if I only we will accept these things on confidential terms. But the same thing in the particular case, depending how they're filed, we are a public document. Now the issue that concerns in relation to the answer that the Honourable Gentleman has given, and
perhaps you might want to reflect on what I'm about to say to him, is that if the claim, and I don't mean it, but if the claim is a claim for damages, and perhaps a specific performance is damages and utility, or both, the problem with the answer the Honourable Gentleman has given to this House is that he's already searching for alternatives and it appears that the relationship is broken down, and therefore it might affect and might impact on the case of specific performance. Perhaps the Honourable Gentleman might want to reflect on that and perhaps clarify that what he's not suggesting is that the government has, at this moment in time, already made the decision to look for an alternative, but the government is looking for an alternative. Should the government need to look for an alternative, depending on how the proceedings go in relation to the claim for specific performance? And of course, these are public proceedings, and it may be used against the Honourable Gentleman. Which is why, Mr. Speaker, I know that the Honourable Gentleman said the government is currently actively considering different documents. And as the Honourable Gentleman correctly notes to me, they are public documents. So you're more than happy to get a copy and we can discuss them.
Question 552, the Honourable F. M. Gerald.
Mr. Speaker, can the Honourable Minister for Transport provide the Council with an update on the replacement of the Gibraltar West Link?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Commercial Affairs, Public Transport and the Port.
Mr. Speaker, following a pre-qualification questionnaire, five companies were invited to tender. Three companies have submitted their proposal and vehicles have been brought to Gibraltar for testing. The results of these tests, together with the tender submissions, are currently being considered by the Procurement Office Board, constituted to consider the tender. It is anticipated that this board will be making its recommendations to government in the near future, and the government expects to announce an adjudication of this tender in early December of this year.
Can the Honourable Gentleman say whether, is the Honourable Minister able to say whether there is a time frame in mind once the process is complete? I'm mindful that he's just said that they're in the tender process. Whether there is a time frame for delivery of or for the rollout of the new buses in the coming months and years that he may be able to share with us.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, the answer is, according to what I'm told by the Procurement Office, which is of course not just by my office directly, that once the buses are ordered, it should take 12 months.
Can the Honourable Minister say whether, of the tenders being considered, any of them are for eco-friendly vehicles, and if they are, the nature of those vehicles, whether in the one or two or the tender, a general indication would be welcome.
Mr. Speaker, first of all, it goes without saying that we would wish to choose the most environmentally friendly vehicle. But of course, we're not considering tenders yet. We're not considering tenders yet. I said in the original answer to my question that we have to wait to receive the recommendations of the tender board so that I can answer the question with precision.
Question 553, the Honourable F. M. Pereira.
Can the Honourable Minister for Transport provide details of the steps being taken to cater for the gaps in the waters being experienced as the aging bus fleet undergoes routine and unexpected maintenance?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Commercial Affairs, Public Transport and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, the steps that the Water Bus Company Limited can undertake to cater for any gaps in resources remain as contractually set out in the agreement and advocacy of government of the water inherited from the previous administration and to which it was contractually bound until August of 2014.
Mr. Speaker, I might take from the Minister's reply that he is not open to discussing what it is the bus company is actually currently doing in relation to filling the gaps that in resources that they're experiencing in terms of what we think the vehicles are being used and such like. Mr. Speaker, from what I'm open to discussing any supplementary with the young which I've been asking, and simply answering the question that he has, and the bus company is taking down contracting to a particular private operator in terms of how we can maneuver to fill the gaps and resources. But if you want to know whether this is in the mechanics, if it's only that bus were to, for whatever reason, require some maintenance or repairs, then any placement then is that bus is used. If a Mercedes bus is used, then that must be sent to Spain for repairs, and another bus, Toyota Poster, or another Toyota would be used to replace it. Those are the simple logistics of filling in gaps when one bus is being required to be is undertaken repairs. I know what the Honourable Minister said. However, in respect of at least the benefit, just picking up on the example that he's given, the Honourable Minister has said that it's a benefit bus breakdown and another benefit bus replaces it on the route. I have no suspicion personally, and others have seen that there are replacement buses which are not benefit buses currently servicing certain routes, namely Toyota Posters as well. But since the Minister mentioned that if a Dennis bus is undergoing maintenance, another Dennis bus will replace it, if there is a finite number of Dennis buses, and one assumes, and I'll be corrected if I'm mistaken, that all Dennis buses are being used or are already deployed on routes in Gibraltar, that where one is undergoing maintenance and another replaces it, you're already short of one because they're all deployed. I don't know whether perhaps the Minister can provide further information in that regard.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman is correct to say that if going to the Dennis bus breaks down and requires repairs, then the bus manager can look at which buses are available for that particular route. The Honourable Gentleman also needs to take into consideration that it depends when a bus breaks down, that a particular route may be a slow route or one is not generally used, so that the manager can, in fact, delay the coming of the time code by 35 minutes, and there's one bus left. But what the Honourable Gentleman needs to take into account, as I said in the answer to the question, is that we are bound by the contract that's in place, and we're very much limited by those contractual restraints.
Next question. Question 554, the Honourable S. M. Guerrero.
Okay, yes. Can the Honourable Minister of Transport say how he plans to tackle the lack of availability of taxi drivers at any given time, to take full advantage of the new GPS-enabled taxi?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Commercial Affairs, Public Transport and the Port.
Mr. Speaker, in the first place, I can't accept the premise of the question, which is cast in extremely wide and general terms. It is not the case that there is a lack of taxis, which is what I suppose he meant, rather than a lack of taxi drivers, because there are more taxi drivers than there are taxis. So I'm reading this question to mean a lack of taxis at all places and at all times. In fact, since the introduction of the new taxi city service regulations and the employment and deployment of seven transport inspectors, I have received a consistent positive feedback from a much improved city service. Further, as I have said in previous occasions in this house, the new GPS tracking system, which provides real-time vehicle positioning and status updates together with the recruitment of the inspectors, allows government to monitor a road, taxi rank, the coach terminal, and the airport. Therefore, if a transport inspector receives a dispatch call, a complaint, or a feedback that there is a lack of availability of taxis in a particular area, the officer has the legal power should immediately instruct a taxi to attend the area where the service would need to be provided. This was a power that did not exist before and was not introduced. I conclude by reminding the Honourable Gentleman that the effectiveness of the new system is actually being monitored daily by the inspectors, whom I meet very regularly. And as indeed I do with the Gibraltar Taxi Association. And as I noted in my press release of the 15th of July, the Gibraltar Taxi Association and I have agreed, of course along with the transport inspector, to review the situation 3 months from the date of the new city service to determine any changes that are required to be made.
Mr. Speaker, by way of clarification, and this might be of some help to the Minister, the question was drafted specifically in terms of taxi drivers, given representations that I have received personally from a number of taxi drivers, that the system, for all its virtues and positive feedback that we may have had since its inception, all of which is certainly welcome on this side of the House, and I'm sure community-wide, the representations that I have received is that it is a very good system, but a system that the effectiveness of which is limited only by the availability of numbers at any given time. Hence, posing the question of taxi drivers available at any given time. It may well be that in the Minister's assessment there are enough taxis, certainly, but if at any given time there is a lack of taxi drivers requiring those taxis, the effectiveness of the system may be limited thereby. That was the point of the question being asked, and I'm grateful to the Minister for the replies, and certainly take note of the fact that this is something that's under review, and we will revisit at some point in the future. This happens.
Question 555, the Honourable S. M. Viella.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I note that the question is directed at the Minister for Traffic, but that the Minister for Transport will be answering it.
Can the Honourable Minister for Traffic say how long the coach park will be located on the former naval grounds?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Commercial Affairs, Public Transport and the Port.
Mr. Speaker, to facilitate the construction of the affordable housing scheme on the site of the current coach park at Waterport, the coach park will temporarily be moved to the naval ground. Details are currently being finalised for the permanent relocation of the coach park, and an announcement on this will be made in due course.
Is the Honourable Minister in a position to confirm that the permanent location of the coach park is intended to be the site of the old airport?
Mr. Speaker, different options are being considered.
Speaker, is the old terminal one of those options which are which is being considered?
Mr. Speaker, all means that.
Question 556, the Honourable S. M. Pierre.
Mr. Speaker, can the Honourable Minister of Transport say, further to question number 217 of 2013, which options the government is exploring for public service vehicle access to the area of the border during peak times as an alternative to the runway crossing?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Commercial Affairs, Public Transport and the Port.
Mr. Speaker, the position remains the same as set out in my answer to question number 217 of this year.
Mr. Speaker, the Minister, in answer to question 217, said, and I quote that at that point, at this point, I would only like to say that there has been some extensive consultation with different operators. He mentioned the DSSB and various other stakeholders as part of that consultation, and this was back in, in May of this year. Has there been no progress on that agenda since that meeting, Mr. Speaker?
I think I've given some details to the House previously in respect to this essential matter. Of course, the Honourable Gentleman is talking about an area which is not controlled by Majesty 7 to Gibraltar. Much of the area in question is controlled by the Ministry of Defence, we're talking about a military runway.
and therefore this is initiative is being dealt with principally by mainly relation to questions of the Ministry of Defence. And those are not things that move quickly or opposed sometimes, given the safety issues that affect crossing the runway other than up to Winston Churchill Road. So, Peter, there is nothing more to report at this time. When there is, I have no doubt that we will want to make a public announcement about it if those actions progress. Yes, Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to the Honourable Chief Minister for his input. The NOD issue is not one that was flagged in reply to the original question that he was in May. But certainly the Minister did intimate that discussions were afoot and that options were being considered. And certainly he did suggest that we could revisit the issue a few months. And this is where we are today. But is the government in any position to disclose what options, if any, are being considered? Mr. Speaker, well, one is forthcoming with information. One finds that there's constantly then going back at one. I think it would have been obvious to the Honourable Gentleman that by talking about the runway, he is talking about the Ministry of Defence, and one didn't have to explicitly flag up the Ministry of Defence because it's implicit when we're talking about the runway. But if I could just refer him to the subject of the question, he's talking about public service vehicle access to the area of the border during peak times as an alternative to the runway crossing. And because if one wanted to be pedantic and not give information, one would say there is no alternative of access to the frontier other than through the runway, whether that is across the Winston Churchill Avenue or whether it is elsewhere on the runway. It has to be on the runway unless we are proceeding with a tunnel, in which case I would have expected the question was about the tunnel or about the new environmentally friendly floating buses that would have to float their way somehow to the border. So Mr. Speaker, it clearly must be an issue that he would have understood in discussing the Ministry of Defence. Now, but whenever there is something to report, there will either be a public statement or there will be something said in this House. He must agree with me that it is desirable that we should find, if possible, alternatives to public service vehicles so that they do not have to get caught. Not necessarily in queues coming north to south, we're talking more about queues going south to north at different times of the day, and not necessarily related to the issues that we have to get in front of, simply traffic issues.
Question 557. The Honourable Mrs. Ayanna Lohan, on behalf of the Honourable J.J. Medler.
And Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Mr. Medler is currently giving evidence in the Horizon Inquiry, so Mr. Medler will be asking his questions today. Mr. Speaker, given the overall dimensions of the mid-harbour small boat marina project, can the Minister for the Port state if he is satisfied that such a size will not hinder the movement of large cruise liners within the port?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Commercial Affairs, Public Transport and the Port.
Mr. Speaker, as part of the planning process, the port was consulted by the project manager on a number of occasions. The area specified as being suitable for the development of the marina was agreed. In doing this, a minimum clearance of 400 metres was specified, which would provide adequate manoeuvring space for any vessel, which would of dimensions able to use the berth on the inside of the Western Arm.
Mr. Speaker, can the Honourable Minister say who the experts are that he consulted in order for this conclusion to have to arrive at?
Mr. Speaker, I've just said in the answer to the question that the captain of the port was consulted by the project manager.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Minister referred to a survey in answer to question 549 to my Honourable friend, Mr. Racino, which enabled the tender process to go ahead. Could Parliament have a copy of the findings of this survey?
The environmental impact assessment, the copy was forwarded by the Honourable the Minister for the Environment to the Honourable Mr. Meggett.
Question 558, the Honourable Mrs. Ayanna Lou Hammond on behalf of the Honourable J.J.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Tourism and the Port say that the result of the Spanish government's decision to stop the transportation of sand and stone through the frontier, will this mean a delay in the completion of the Sandy Bay reinstatement and stabilisation of the beach, including the combination of breakwater groins? And if so, how does the government intend to finalise the project?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Commercial Affairs, Public Transport and the Port.
Mr. Speaker, we do not expect any delays to arise in respect to the completion of the work in time for the next bathing season. With regards to the supply of sand for beach defenders, government has invited tenders for this prior to the announcement of the Spanish blockade. Tenders have now been received and accounts have been assessed, and an award of tender is expected shortly. There is no delay to the development of the project anticipated.
Question 667, the Honourable D. J. Buckingham.
Can the Minister of Responsibility for Aviation provide details to the House of the payment of any that have been made to the former commercial manager at Terminal Management Limited?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Commercial Affairs, Public Transport and the Port.
Mr. Speaker, I will be answering the question of the Minister for Tourism and Commercial Affairs. As I arrived in the House to answer the question, I clarify that I understand the question to ask whether Her Majesty's Government of Gibraltar made a payment to the former commercial manager of Terminal Management Limited due to the termination by the previous administration of its position at Terminal Management Limited. The answer is that Her Majesty's Government of Gibraltar has made no payment to the former commercial manager at Terminal Management Limited for termination of his employment by the previous administration. Speaker, that answer applies to the government-owned company as well. In other words, it wasn't a government-owned company which was making a payment to the former commercial manager. So, what I'm asking is whether the government has made any payments to the former commercial manager at the airport. And what I'm asking is whether Terminal Management Limited itself has, which I understand the government and company, whether it itself has, it isn't, yes, assist the House for the purposes of perhaps with Mr. Casino, then formulating supplementary wishes. Terminal Management Limited was always a private entity, which had an exclusive contract with the government to run the terminal, and I believe that the directors were the shareholders of that company.
Question 559, the Honourable Mrs. Ayanna Lou Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, further to the answer given to question number 218 of 2013, can the Minister with responsibility for the Fire Brigade say when the Fire Brigade audit report will be made public and what the main findings of the task?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Sport, Culture and Heritage and Youth.
Mr. Speaker, I cannot state at this stage when the report is going to be made public.
This will happen once the government and the unions have finished the strategy of implementation of the report's relevant recommendations.
Mr. Speaker, has the Honourable the Minister already discussed the report with the staff and management?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Speaker, in May, the Honourable Minister said the time frame would be no more than a further 2 months. When does the Honourable Minister envisage you'll be able to provide a copy of this report?
Mr. Speaker, I stated in the answer that I've just answered your question is as soon as once the government and the unions have finished the strategy for implementation of the report's relevant recommendations. So until that time, we are not in a position to publish it.
Mr. Speaker, does the Honourable Minister have an idea of how long it will take to formulate the strategy?
No, I do not have at this moment, because it's been a work in progress. And until we have all the meetings with the union, which we are having, and discussing the report, we're not in a position to go out publicly with the report.
Question 516, the Honourable E.J. Baird.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Sport and Leisure provide details of the alternative facilities which will be provided to the Gibraltar Cricket Association as a result and consequence of the loss of accessibility of Gibraltar Sports Ground for the playing, teaching and development of the sport?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Sport, Culture and Heritage and Youth.
No, Mr. Speaker, not as you said, but I have met in various occasions with representatives of the Gibraltar Cricket Association, the most recent on the 24th of July and the 30th of August, and we're still in discussions with them in this issue.
Mr. Speaker, not as a result of those discussions and so on, are a diminishing of efficiency sort of homers into what sort of areas are being seriously considered by both sides of alternative facilities?
Not quite, but no.
Mr. Speaker, does the Minister have any possible time frame by which he hopes to have alternative facilities available for the Cricket Association?
Well, this, Mr. Speaker, is determined by as soon as we start implementing the time, the usage of the Europa Conference. At present, cricket is still being played there. So there isn't any problem at this stage.
So, Mr. Speaker, am I going to confirm that I am correct in deducting from that, in that until alternative sites and premises are available for the playing of sport and so on, the accessibility to the local sports ground will still continue in favour of the cricket association?
Not necessarily, Mr. Speaker.
Then, Mr. Speaker, unfortunately, for the cricket facility, there could be a period of time when they have no access to an actual playing field and so on.
Well, Mr. Speaker, this is a balancing act, the Honourable Gentleman will note. It could be, but we certainly hope it will not be, and we will do everything possible to ensure that it does not come about, that cricket will not have facilities available because of the need to break ground on the GFA's weather standard pitch. Now, this is an issue of space, and I am sure that the Honourable Gentleman shares the government's desire that cricket should have the best possible facilities available to it as the alternative to Europa as soon as possible. But unfortunately, Mr. Speaker, 2.5 miles by 1 mile, it is not always possible to move with the speed that one would wish. But he must take from the answers to these questions, which do not just involve the Honourable Member, because it involves the wider land plan of Gibraltar, that the government is moving with great alacrity to ensure that in so far as possible, there will not be a day when cricket will not have facilities available to it as a result of the need to also make available to GFA
the alternative area in Europa, which they and UEFA have identified as the best place for the GFA UEFA standard statement.
Question 561, the Honourable E.J. Hale.
Can the Minister for Sport and Leisure say to be had, since the answer to question number 519 of 2013, held the discussions with the Gibraltar Rugby Football Union in respect of providing renewed facilities for the playing, teaching, and development of the sport, and, if so, provide details of any agreements reached?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Sport, Culture, Heritage, and Youth.
Mr. Speaker, I have met with the Gibraltar Rugby Football Union on a number of occasions informally. A further meeting has been arranged for this month.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I know that the Minister says he's met them informally and he has a meeting planned. I wish to express to the Minister concern and confirmation from him. It's possible that he also shares my concern that recently in a sports report in the local daily paper, there was some concern being expressed by members of the rugby fraternity about having to borrow MOD facilities and having turned up on the weekend and those not being available due to other MOD things. So for the Minister to confirm, you know, he's sharing of my concerns as well as though the role for brothers that we really have to work together with the rugby fraternity to get an adequate facility to ensure that that sport progresses, not so in the light of attending applications for international membership.
I think I want to say to you the whole government with those sentiments, because the government has supported and will support the application of the Gibraltar Rugby Football Union to become a federated internationally, and we continue to do so. But I want to go a bit further, Mr. Speaker, and say that we shouldn't just be working on that together as a community. We should have the full support of the Minister of Defence in doing so. And the Minister of Defence enjoys the facilities that the government makes available to the whole community as members of this community, important members of this community as they are. And its own support facilities should, in my view, therefore also be shared with the community so far as possible when security concerns are not relevant. And this is an issue that I have taken up directly with the Ministry of Defence as part of the ongoing discussions with the Ministry of Defence about all issues related to defence in Gibraltar and the footprint of the Ministry of Defence in Gibraltar. And I'm sure that you want to associate with those comments too.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I will unreservedly associate myself with the feeling of this paper to Minister. He can certainly count on the unanimous support as well from this side of the House. I think that the Minister, in a succinct manner, has analysed the situation carefully, and certainly the whole of the Gold Club will unite behind the Minister on that matter for the benefit of sport and keep our certain relationship with the MOD at in equal sharing, and we must always give as well as we do. Thank you for that to me.
Question 562, the Honourable E.J. Hale.
Can the Minister for Sport and Leisure say how many vacancies currently exist within the Gibraltar Sport and Leisure Authority and by when the authority expects to fill these vacancies?
Also, the Honourable the Minister for Sport, Culture, Heritage and Youth.
Mr. Speaker, there are two vacancies for the post of sports and leisure assistants. All applicants have already been interviewed and it's projected to be filled the vacancies in November of this year.
Question 563, the Honourable E.J. Hale.
Can the Minister for Sport and Leisure provide details of payments made so far pertaining to the financial year 2013-2014 in respect of sports grants under each of the following? A. Grants to sporting societies. B. International competitions. C. Sports development projects. And D. hosting a special sports and leisure event.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Sports, Culture, Heritage and Youth.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. I now hand over the Honourable Member opposite details of the sports grant awarded so far in the year 13, 14, and after year.
There's not a long scene, really, but I suggest that we proceed with other questions and then the Honourable Mr. Reyes can come back to any supplementaries that may arise from that schedule until we have studied it.
By all means, Mr. Speaker, we have done that before, and it's worked perfectly fine. I am content with that.
Question 564, the Honourable E.J. Reyes.
Can the Minister for Sports and Leisure provide details, inclusive of cost and completion dates, in respect of a new football stadium which is to be built at the site of the Europa Sports Ground?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Sports, Culture, Heritage and Youth.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 565 and 566.
Question 565.
Can the Minister for Sport and Leisure provide details in respect of any possible losses pertaining to the existing playground or recreation areas at Europa Point, which may occur as a result of the development of the new football stadium in that area?
Question 566.
Can the Minister for Sport and Leisure confirm that the new football stadium to be built at Europa will fall under the auspices of the vote of sports and leisure authority?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Sports, Culture, Heritage and Youth.
Mr. Speaker, it is anticipated that the new football stadium at Europa will not be a GSLA asset, but a GSA asset. Costings, etc., are not yet finalised. Lots of facilities, etc., will not be clear until final plans are laid before the DPC by the ESA.
Mr. Speaker, if the new stadium there will not fall under the auspices of the sports authority, but run instead of the GSA, is it, am I correct in assuming there that it will then be a donation to the local government to build the sports facilities and pump it over entirely to a sporting association for which then the taxpayer has no control or say in it?
Well, Mr. Speaker, details of that kind have not yet been decided with the GSA, so therefore it needs to be decided. But the asset will definitely be managed and taken over by the GSA as to how much they will pay, or how much is the contract, and all that. I haven't got any details on that yet.
And Mr. Speaker, will the minister also bear very much in mind that, for example, during normal school hours, that facilities for football there and so on could be made available, you know, to schools in all sectors as an extension of the current existing sporting facilities within our education system?
Well, Mr. Speaker, that will be up to the GSA. I'm sure the GSA will gladly have some children there playing football and doing sports there. But again, this is up to the GSA and how they handle the stadium. But being a football association, I would doubt very, very much that they will not allow schools or children if they so desire to use it. So it's a question of seeing how the GSA is going to manage that. It's up to them.
So the GSA, in my interpretation, is that the GSA are the ones who are going to decide how, when, and by whom those facilities are being used. Would that mean then that in exchange for that, the GSA will give up its current daily allocations at the territorial stadium so that the GSA can then allocate those to other bodies?
No, Mr. Speaker, not necessarily. Again, I suppose it's work in progress, it depends. I mean, we can't, what the Honourable Member then saying is that the GFA do use the, or the schools use the football, they're not going to use the football in the further season. I think it's a question of the GFLA working with the GFA to see how they can maximise and the stadium being under the management of the GFA to maximise the area, to maximise the use of the stadium. But again, it's exactly the GFA to coordinate with the GFLA.
I'm just thinking that the Minister of Defence said he what the running costs and so on of the new Europa Stadium, that the bill for that would be borne as well by the taxpayer, or would that be borne by the GSA from whatever other income they can derive?
Well, Mr. Speaker, if it is run and managed by the GSA, I'm assuming that the GSA will have to have the funds to run the place, and running costs will be under the GSA. So, if yes, the answer is yes, the GSA will have to manage the stadium. How then they do it and how would where the funds come to play?
And the government envisage sort of any refund from the GSA for its initial investment cost in the building of the stadium, or that be entirely a gift from the government to the GSA?
Mr. Speaker, I think I've already answered that question. It's up to the GSA to run its place, and we have not got into those details yet.
Maybe I didn't explain myself. Yes, the minister did answer about the run and so on. What I'm saying is the cost towards building, which the minister has said that he still doesn't have the details and so on. And what I'm saying is if the government is going to pay for the cost of building that stadium and then pass it over to GSA to manage to upkeep and so on, will the government, have an incentive of recouping from that point of view saying some of the money that it is investing in building of the stadium, or is the government considering giving it as a gift to the GFA?
I just say that we have to be very careful with how we deal with these matters now, because the GFA is now a member of an international organization which has its own rules and which prescribes what it is that football associations can do and what their relationships with governments are. For example, if there were not such barriers, Mr. Speaker, then Germany, for example, if that was the best performing economy in Europe, could simply pump money into its football team and they would then have a huge advantage. So there are rules as to what it is that football associations that are members of the European Federation of Football Associations can do in their interaction with the government. And there are rules as to how they fund their headquarters and their, if you call it their national football stadium, Mr. Speaker, but their national football stadium in that parlance doesn't mean the state football stadium. It means the football stadium in the ownership of the National Football Association. And for that purpose, Mr. Speaker, as I understand it, in my discussion with the GSA in relation to the land issue that arises here, the UEFA have a fund to assist for the various infrastructure projects in all of the federated states. And through that funding, entities that are football associations in each of the 54 states that are members of UEFA fund their stadium and their other arrangements, like the management of the environmental deference of the stadium, which then produces income. And of course, you know, the German Football Federation will have a larger stadium but will produce more income than smaller federations may have. But it's not a question of government being free, however much you might wish to, of being free to inject a lot of cash into their football association. And I believe that the fund is called the Patrick Fund, and I'm no expert on this, which is the one that is used to assist federations to develop their stadium and their facilities. And there are other funds available for the development of young football, etc. So in all of that context, and this is what the Honourable Minister is alluding to, in all of that context, there are a lot of rules
and that is the subject of discussion at the moment between the government and the GSA and the GSA and Westland. What I think I am able to disclose, Mr. Speaker, I think we've alluded to before, and it may not be a disclosure, it may be something that the other gentleman has already been told by us in this House, is that, of course, the government feels that it is able, within the rules, to donate, to gift the land of the stadium, or the stadium will be built, to the GSA. That is within the rules. That appears to be within the rules, and we can do that because it is for a sporting purpose. So in the same way that we might give the Cricket Federation or the Rugby Federation or any other federation the use of a particular area and even create a lease in relation to whatever facilities we're able to use there, in this instance, because the facilities cannot be public facilities, that new stadium cannot be a public stadium. It has to be a GSA-owned stadium. The advice that we have is that we can go as far as to gift the land. And so that stage one is where you do it. Well, that can be given by the nation to the GSA's structure for this purpose, which is likely to be a corporation, as long as the lease provides and is only to be used for sporting purposes. Otherwise, of course, if somebody were to buy from the GSA to then build houses on it, that would be entitled to a payment for the change of use, right? But the grant of the land, the gifting of the land into a structure set up by the GSA for this purpose, is within the rules. What happens there after that, we have to be very circumspect about what the rules at a European level allow us to do and don't allow us to do. I hope that's helpful. Yes, Mr. Speaker, that is excellent. I'm grateful because the two minutes have actually been able to clarify what. The old report in the street hears and knows quite certain, the veracity behind that thing, and the vast means, that's why I hinted upon some of these questions. Certainly, between Minister and Minister of Sport can just say that, where things have been done properly, they will receive the full support from this side of the House, in respect of all that. But I may even tie that, Mr. Speaker, with your permission, to the previous question on cricket about where you can go for sports grounds. It's public knowledge that the Gibraltar Cricket Association are actually members of the ICC and hence derive some funding. They are worried, and I've probably shared this thought already with the minister, that they could lose certain funding, even the membership could be put in jeopardy, if they don't meet the minimum requirements of playing teams that are available. I know in my time in the sport, they needed to have at least three different sites where the game could be played. But as a similar to this guy, we clarify, before with the Minister of the Sport, that if there is any time span of non-availability of the pitch, it would be a very short period of time, and that, I think, will be very well received by the Gibraltar Cricket Association. And may I, Mr. Speaker, indulge in the generosity and ask the Minister and the Minister for Sport and the Gibraltar House to share with me the acknowledgement that the Gibraltar Cricket Association is actually making history today by playing in the under 19 UEFA qualifiers this afternoon, half past two kickoff, which unfortunately, I think many of us will have to miss. But I'm sure we will be updated by today's date in the report. Yes, Mr. Speaker. In fact, arrangements have been made for these schools to show them out while students are testing time goes on. Mr. Speaker, the government is very alive to the issues of the Gibraltar Cricket Association, as I've told them before. But he's alluded to something that I think we are commenting on, which is that they receive funding. And the Rugby Federation, if it becomes federated, will also receive funding. And again, then there are options for them to enable them to develop their facilities with that funding, something which they have not been able to do until now with the existing regime, because all of the areas that each of them have been using are public areas which are multi-use. And the difficulty with the speaker is, and the opportunity, in finding them an area which is exclusively used, because then their federations fund the development of that facility. And although it may be taking a little bit longer than any of us might want because of the territorial extent of Gibraltar, right? And there are some people who go going to even like the fact that we find it a little bit bigger. It is certainly something that is very much on the government's agenda as a deliverable, which would provide exclusive use facilities wherever possible, or shared exclusive use facilities, right, and make that clearer. For example, rugby and cricket may be able to share, but it's exclusively theirs in joint ownership, and therefore their federations can certainly fund. And finally, Speaker, if I can say this on behalf of the government and people of Gibraltar, on behalf of this Parliament, Godspeed to the under 19 today. I know that they had a tough friendly match in preparation. I know that they will do their best. Gibraltarians always try their best when they're abroad. This is only the beginning. And, Mr. Speaker, we have great hope for what the Gibraltar national team will be able to do when they go abroad in particular. The one thing they will always do is represent us in a sterling fashion, representing all the hopes and aspirations of the people of Gibraltar for success on the day. So God speak to them differently.
Question 567, the Honourable E.J. Willis.
Mr. Speaker, further to the answer to question number 236 of 2013, can the Minister for Heritage provide details of all work, together with respective costs, undertaken at any heritage-related site, stating by whom these works were carried out?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Sport, Culture, Heritage and Youth.
Mr. Speaker, further to the answer to question 236 of 2013, I now hand over the Honourable Member opposite the information requested.
Again, can we attempt to make progress while the information is being circulated and considered?
Question 568, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Further to the answer to question number 523 of 2013, can the Minister for Heritage provide full details of all work undertaken at Parsons Lodge during the financial year 2013-2014, inclusive of information pertaining to costs and contractors who carried out any work?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Sport, Culture, Heritage and Youth.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 569.
Question 569.
Further to the answer to question number 523 of 2014, can the Minister for Heritage provide full details of all work undertaken at Modest Castle during the financial year 2013-14, inclusive of information pertaining to costs and contractors who carried out any work?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Sport, Culture, Heritage and Youth.
Speaker, first to answer the question 523 of 2013. Further work carried out at the Parsons Lodge is as follows. Contractor for our construction, total amount was £1,553.14, and the works were removed, supplied, and fixed a new flagpole. As to answer the question 569, no further work has been carried out at no cost.
Question 570, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Can the Minister for Culture provide details of cultural grants awarded so far pertaining to financial year 2013-14?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Sport, Culture, Heritage and Youth.
I now hand over the Honourable Member opposite details of the cultural grants awarded so far in this financial year of 2013-2014.
Next question. Question 571, the Honourable E.J. Ray.
Forward to the answer to question Griffin 61 of 2013 and number 522 of 2013, can the Minister for Cultural Heritage stay in the position of caretaker at the Magic of Paul Wood City?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Sports, Cultural Heritage and Youth.
Mr. Speaker, I think you can answer the question 522 of 2013. The Ministry for Sport, Culture, Heritage and Youth have no intention of advertising this space. This will be decided by the Culture and Heritage Agency and the Board of the Magic Forum.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I'm very much aware of what you said, but I didn't say that the Ministry is in the point. They said, when will the position of caretaker be filled, whoever the ultimate employer happens to be?
It is up to the employer when they want to advertise it and bring it out. At present, I have not heard of any indication from them that they want to advertise. So they must be doing all the work internally, and it's up to them to decide.
From my note, the last time you answered the question, which was question number 522, he explained that the vacancy was going to be advertised and filled in by the agency, but he said it would be happening soon. Has there now been a shift in position, Mr. Speaker?
Mr. Speaker, which answer to which question are you referring? I've got answer to question 562. I stated the Ministry for Culture has no intention of advertising this post. And in written question 61, is my answer to question 235 of 13, the caretaker for the Magistrate Hall retired. The vacancy will be advertised in due course. And by saying that, Mr. Speaker, in due course, the ministry is not advertising. No intention from the ministry to advertise, but it would be in due course.
That clearly is not the point. The point is that the minister, as minister, is responsible overall for the Culture and Heritage Agency. So he is in a position to answer questions on their behalf.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, and I also chair the Magic of Paul Board, management of the board. And I am stated here that this item has not come up from them because they are the ones that manage it. I am just but the chairman. They have not come to me or to the board indicating that this vacancy will be advertised. And therefore, what I am saying is that the ministry is not advertising because it is not incumbent on the ministry to advertise. It would be the matter to fall itself and board of management of nothing to say to decide. And like I said, I've said those meetings and there is no indication that they are asking for the vacancy to be filled at this stage.
We need the function of the chairman of the board perhaps to set the agenda?
I am sure, but if somebody retires and the management, the facilities manager, does not come to the board and say, Minister, or Mr. Chairman, we need someone to replace Mr. Mr. Bahuhu and Mr. Brown. In fact, there are two people who retired. One retired are subsequent to us. They have not come back to me and said, we need a person. So I am assuming that they are either doing internal cover, or maybe, I say, maybe in the next board meeting, they could welcome the minister we've been covering for the last few months. We need those posts to be covered as soon as possible. And then the board takes the decision and brings out the vacancy if the board decides that the vacancy should be brought out.
So then Mr. Speaker, can the minister confirm that there has actually been a shift in position? Because I think I am correct in interpreting from the answer given to question number 522, where this house was told that the agency would bring out the vacancy for caretaker and that it would be happening soon. And am I correct now in assuming what's happening today that that does not seem to be happening and in any case no one has been seen?
As soon as the next board meeting, if they bring it up,
which is the answer to the other question I just explained. So if they come to me and don't explicitly say that they need, when I say soon, it means that I go to the board then discusses the issue, which has not arisen, because the board has not discussed the issue that they can see, but I'm sure they will, because they are covering up a person with the stuff that they've got currently. They're covering up. So as far as I'm concerned, and you should know as a minister, that they always, in the department, always asking for more and more staff. In this case, they have not asked readily now for the staff, but I'm sure they will. And they'll probably ask for even more to cover, but at this stage, they haven't.
The minister has said this thing to me in his answer that since the retirement of the caretaker, that passion seems to be covered up by somebody else. I can understand when it's very full of admin grade, you know, but I can ask, you know, Clarkett and why to please cover for whatever was left by Clarkett who retired. But, you know, in the position of the caretaker is something that's a bit more specialized, and one at least has to have a minimum do-it-yourself knowledge and so on. Surely, you can't ask a clerk to cover over certain caretaker duties, or does the minister have any information that could at least enlighten me as to who is carrying out the duties, you know, previously carried out by the caretaker, which requires minor work and maintenance, machine maintenance, issues and so on.
Mr. Speaker, a very efficient maintenance team is doing that. He knows that Mr. Brown is not only the only caretaker there. There is also Mr. Victor Foster who was there as well. And he, together with another group of young men, I should say, are doing a very, very good work job, and there are trainees, actually, which is asked the question as well, trainees who have been engaged to do maintenance work. And therefore, they are not only doing the Macintosh story, they are doing all other maintenance work for what he used to preside over, which is the Cultural and Heritage Agency, which does not only involve the Macintosh story, it involves in many other aspects.
And for the record, Mr. Speaker, these trainees, are they part of the Future Watch property, or where do they attend?
The speaker, you've asked the question before you say that.
Question 572, the Honourable Mrs. Ian Marie Hammond, on behalf of the Honourable Jay Davis.
Mr. Speaker, further to the answer provided to question number 239 of 2013, can the Minister with responsibility for utilities state what has been done or is likely to happen in the next few months in order to upgrade the distribution network of the electricity authority?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Sports, Council and Heritage and Youth.
Mr. Speaker, the following improvements to the electrical distribution network resilience have been completed this year with installation of new substations at the new mental health facility, substation and engineer car park. GEA also upgraded electrical supply to the mosque. This is now third from a GEA supply from Kitley Way substation instead of an MOD GMS supply. The fair substation was also recycled to the new location at the Nova Ground. In addition, work is in hand to enhance the network to provide electrical supply to the Sunborne Hotel. GEA are also programming and forcing the distribution electrical network over the next 6 months to allow GEA to take on Edinburgh Estate and Sporting Court, consumers which are currently supplied from the MADG mesh network. As part of an ongoing program to replace and upgrade the high voltage distribution electrical distribution network that was started last year by this government, the GEA has purchased equipment to replace Bedlam Court substation, Palace Galley substation, and Langwell Road, which are currently awaiting delivery. The GEA are also finalizing in finalizing the technical specifications for the replacement of the next class of substations to replace 46 substations, Europa Road substation, Devil Star Road, and Sandy Bay substation.
Question 573, the Honourable Mrs. Anne Marie Herald, on behalf of the Honourable Chairman.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister with the responsibility for utilities please advise the House if a health and safety consequence analysis has been conducted for the proposed site for the new power station, given the answers given by government to written questions numbers 75 and 76 of 2013, and if so, provide Parliament with a copy?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Sport, Council, Heritage and Youth.
The Speaker, no consequence analysis has been carried out in this case for the new power station as previously advised.
Mr. Speaker, if no consequence analysis has been done, how come the government is proceeding with the preliminary work and the tender process?
Mr. Speaker, because no consequence analysis are needed. And I think the Honourable Member, Mr. Nettle, is completely confused as to what needs to be done and what he seems to have got the information from a health and safety course that he attended, and therefore there is no need to have a consequence analysis. What there are many other types of analysis, but not the specific consequence analysis that he refers to. And that is why I answered the question last time when he asked that there is no need for a consequence analysis.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Minister has mentioned many other types of analysis. Could you enlighten us as to what these are and whether they've been conducted?
It's a HAZID, a hazard identification analysis, a COMAH, control of major accidents and hazard analysis, an EIA, Environmental Impact Assessment, and a CGM, Construction, Design and Management Regulations, which we have to say. So those are four that I have on my list in a way.
Given that we are dealing with a power station, I hope all honourable members found that information very illuminating.
Question 574. The Honourable Mr. Simon O'Hallan, on behalf of the Honourable J.J. Maitland.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister with responsibility for utilities please advise the House if work has commenced for the return site for the new power station?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Sport, Council, Heritage and Youth.
Mr. Speaker, the work on the return of the new power station has not yet started.
Mr. Speaker, does the Honourable Minister have an idea as to when the work will start?
Mr. Speaker, I cannot say when. I can inform the Honourable Lady that it's within an EIA at this present time, so it's at that basis, an EIA basis. But I wouldn't like to say again when we start.
Question 575, the Honourable Mr. Brian Leo Hammond, on behalf of the Honourable J.J. Nick.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister with responsibility for utilities please advise the House if an environment impact assessment has been conducted at the proposed reclaimed site for a new power station, and if so, please provide a copy to Parliament? And obviously, I'm aware that you answered this question in the previous question.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Sport, Council, Heritage and Youth.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, the environmental impact assessment for the new power station will be conducted by the successful contractor. Government has done a preliminary assessment to inform the EIA that the detailed assessment can only be done once the final award of tender is made, as it is a project
question 545, the Honourable D.J. Buffin.
Can the Minister for the Environment advise whether a strategy has now been developed in relation to the upper lot?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to ask this question of the Minister's responsibility for the upper lot. The strategy for the upper lot is currently being developed by the Department of the Environment in consultation with the Ministry for Tourism. We hope that the draft plan will be ready for consultation with stakeholders by December this year.
Mr. Speaker, in answer to when I posed the question of the Minister for Tourism back in May 2012, he said that I asked about the consultation that was being undertaken by the government, and the answer received was that the next step is that a paper will now be prepared by the Department of the Environment. Is this the paper that he just mentioned, which will be ready in December of this year?
Indeed, this is the draft that we are referring to.
And Mr. Speaker, when do we expect that we have the plan ready thereafter? Because what I assume is going to happen is that once the paper is prepared, if I've understood and followed his answer correctly, it will then be sent out for further consultation, to be sort of input from various stakeholders, and by stakeholders maybe we can clarify whether it will include the broader sense possible to the environmental lobby and also the taxi drivers who make use of that facility. After that is complete, we will have a plan ready, and I asked him at the beginning of my question how long he expected that would be, how long he expected that would take for that to be ready.
Because the stakeholders are precisely as described, and we include those entities and individuals who made submissions when this was, when submissions were invited from members of the public. As to time frame, I would not like to commit myself. One thing I have learned in the past 21, 22 months is to be careful when I commit myself to time frame.
Fine, Mr. Speaker, I think I'll leave it there for now, and we'll see how matters progress post December. But can he give an indication as to the nature of the representations that he's receiving, and whether the government is developing as a government a view as to which way whether the environmental lobbyists will win the day? I don't put it in very stark terms, I appreciate that. Or whether the taxi drivers will have their day, because clearly, I can appreciate from their standpoint that it must be not an easy decision to take. Because I imagine that their submissions and the views as to how the upper office to be used will be diametrically opposed, and they have both sides have sort of valid interest in that area of land. So, can you give us an indication of those is my question?
Speaker, I suppose it should be argued that the environmental lobbyists won the day when they elected me as minister. But there is no conflict of this nature. In any natural asset where there is a large amount of public use, there are challenges, obviously we are aware of those challenges. But the way that I see the plan developing and the amount of work that I have seen already, and I am not involved, sadly, in the day-to-day, I would very much like to be able to write the plan myself, but clearly I have very competent officials for doing this. I think we're going to come up with something that is going to work very, very well for the users of the upper rock, of all species, including humans and others.
question 576, the Honourable S.M. Segarra.
Mr. Speaker, can the Honourable the Minister for the Environment provide this House with details of all costs already incurred in respect of the creation of the Commonwealth Park, further to the initial cost of £87,000 incurred in respect of the neighbouring work, including but not limited to excavation work, provision of parking spaces in alternative locations, design work, materials, and all other relevant expenses?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 577 to 579.
Question 577.
Can the Honourable Minister for the Environment provide details of the government's estimate of the total investment that expects will be required for the creation of the Commonwealth Park?
Question 578.
Can the Honourable Minister for the Environment provide details to this House of the manner in which the Commonwealth Park project will be funded, in particular, whether the government intends to fund the project from the total facility expenses of the Gibraltar Savings Bank?
Question 579.
Can the Honourable Minister for the Environment provide details to this House of setbacks or difficulties, if any, encountered in the construction of the Commonwealth Park and, where relevant, the cost of remedial works?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Environment.
Mr. Speaker, although for reasons I will refer to in a moment, we will not give an estimate of what the park will cost, I will tell him that to date a total of £1,119,208.20 have been spent on the Commonwealth Park project, inclusive of all enabling work and consulting fees. As stated in answer to question 784 of 2012, the development of the car park at King's Wharf site is part of an agreement with the developer of the site at no cost to Her Majesty's Government of Gibraltar. The exact cost of the project will not be known until the final account has been agreed with the contractor. The project will be funded by a combination of a contribution from the Fistula Trust and by government own funds. The project will also receive EU funding. No other sources of funding are being considered. There have been no setbacks or difficulties in the construction of the Commonwealth Park beyond what might be expected on a scheme of this size and complexity. The project is on program for completion by the end of March 2014.
I'm grateful to the Honourable Minister for his reply in that regard, specifically in relation to the costs incurred so far. I am, however, unable to accept, Mr. Speaker, that they are not in a position to provide an estimate of what or how much it's going to cost. In the context of tender awards having been made or the contract having been awarded for commencement of the work, the value of those awards must clearly be something that the government knows and should therefore be in a position to share with this House. Would the Minister explain this House the reasons why it is unable to provide those estimates when they can, in fact, say, in respect to the housing project, how much those awards have been valued at, the value of £130 million, if I recall correctly? Can the Minister say in this House why, in respect to the Commonwealth Park, that information cannot be provided to the House and to the public?
Speaker, as I have stated before in this House, this is a project that has been carried out by TJVS, there are still discussions progressing with TJVS in some of the details. But I think I can explain that this is not the average project, and this is not the sort of project that can be cut and dry at the initial stages. The development of a garden has a lot of factors that have to be borne in mind. For example, weather conditions. For example, the choice and selection of the mature trees that are going to be brought in. And this cannot be chosen very much in advance and has to be chosen during the time of the project. In fact,
That is a process that is going on now, and it can be very much depending on the actual species and the size of what is available on the market at the moment. And therefore, it's the sort of thing that has to be flexible and cannot be decided beforehand, like, for example, how much cement is going to be used in building a house. Developing a garden has to be flexible. I have considerable experience in this. In order to achieve the best value for money, we have to have this flexibility.
Mr. Speaker, I disagree with the final point that the Honourable Minister is making, that because we have to have this flexibility, we cannot have an estimate. I think that this is entirely on this point. It is entirely possible for a government that knows that it's going to be spending at least £113 million on 2,000 projects to have an idea of what it will be spending in respect of a park, making allowances, of course, for the flexibility that the Minister said needs to have in respect of the project. Mr. Speaker, the Minister surely will agree with me that it is absolutely right that the public should know what the estimate is for the cost of this park in the same way as they know, because the government has freely provided the information, how much the housing project is going to cost. Mr. Speaker, I do not understand, and I ask the Minister to try and enlighten me so that I understand why it is that there is this hesitation to provide that kind of information which should be really in the grand scheme of things, rather innocuous. Mr. Speaker, this is why I say this. We have this debate and this question in almost every meeting of the House in relation to this particular development. Mr. Speaker, we have answered before that we will provide the full cost of the development of the park. And the Honourable Gentleman has wanted to insist and insist that we provide the estimate. The member, the Minister for the Environment, has set out already why it is not possible to provide the estimate in respect of this particular project. It is quite different when one is dealing with fixed price design and build projects like the ones that we are dealing with in relation to the housing scheme, Mr. Speaker, which has been announced, and the respect to which the data has been given. If the Honourable Gentleman doesn't like the answer, well, look, Mr. Speaker, he can say what he likes, but that is the answer he is going to get. This is not an attempt not to tell the public how much the project is going to cost. The Honourable Gentleman is being told he will have chapter and verse and the price of every single daffodil that is relevant, and I defer to the Honourable the Minister for the Environment, and every tulip, on every tree, if he wishes. When the project is complete, he will be able to analyse the cost of the compost, Mr. Speaker, and absolutely every single other aspect of the park, which he has been told, Mr. Speaker, will be completed in less than 6 months' time. So he simply asks the question, how much does it cost, rather than how much will it cost, then he will detect, Mr. Speaker, the willingness to provide that information. At this stage, if the government, in particular the Minister, does not feel comfortable giving the estimate, and he has given him his reasoning as to why he doesn't feel comfortable giving the estimate, well then, Mr. Speaker, I'm afraid he has to accept that answer, with the caveat that there will be a full disclosure of every penny spent, 1 cent, and at the end of the project. Otherwise, Mr. Speaker, we are simply going to have an exercise going on in every meeting of this House until we reach the end of the development, where we give the same answer that we have been giving him for a year, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Chief Minister will know that we have not been dealing with this in every meeting of Parliament since December 2011. In fact, there has been a gap of about 3, 4, 5, 6, perhaps months since we have raised this issue in the House.
It was last raised in July. I have a handset here, the 18th of July, it was last raised in July.
I'm grateful, but it was not this specific question, Mr. Speaker, yes. This issue will be raised as many times as we consider it necessary, and yes, indeed, the Honourable Chief Minister will say that they will give the answer that they want to give. But the point is this, Mr. Speaker, we are asking for the estimate, we are asking whether the government has an estimate, and if it does have an estimate, whether it will share it. The fact that they will not is now clear because that answer has already been provided. As to the cost of the Commonwealth Park, once it has been delivered, well, I will be asking at that time what the cost has been. the question right now is the estimate, because in exactly the same way as the government sees fit to tell the electorate that this is that a housing project is going to cost X, even though we know that those are subject to commercial reality and practical realities on the ground that may cause that figure to change. It is, Mr. Speaker, the public right to understand what the estimate for that task is before it is complete, at the time when it is asked for. It is a very simple question, and it is frankly astounding to members on this side of the House that the government are unable to provide us with what is really a very simple answer. We are certain that, which for many reasons, clearly the government is unhappy to have.
It has nothing to do with that, and really the gentleman needs to understand the parameters of what he's talking about a little bit better before he gets up and tries to embarrass the government. He does not realize, Mr. Speaker, that the tender award for the properties in question at the aerial farm and the coach park are fixed price tenders subject to European rules that cannot vary according to European rules. They are fixed price design and build, Mr. Speaker. That is quite different. Quite different. Those are not estimates, Mr. Speaker. Those are fixed price contracts. Quite different to say, well, look, we're developing something here. We may decide to change some of the specification. We may decide to make something less enhanced or more enhanced. But, Mr. Speaker, look, the whole issue is this. We are the guardians of the public purse on this side of the House. They are there to check us. Very much. They can ask the other questions right. They can ask the same question over and over again. And he's noted, Mr. Speaker, that I wasn't taking the point that the same question had been asked within 6 months. Another point I might have taken, because it was not an issue that we were dealing with on that basis. We are simply saying, as guardians of the public purse, we want to tell you what it costs in detail, every daffodil and every tulip. But we're not going to do, as guardians of the public purse, is tell you the estimate. Because, as guardians of the public purse, we don't think it's in the interest of the public purse that we should do that. We think that the public purse may actually end up better off if we don't share estimates of this sort. Because we've got to explain it before. If you do, some of those who are providing services to you will know how far you're prepared to go. Or if anybody doesn't know that when you prepare estimates of this sort, you also have to build in contingencies. You also have to build in, you know, a percentage of what more you're prepared to spend in the amount that has already been quoted to you. And so, Mr. Speaker, as guardians of the public purse, in the interest of the taxpayer, we are telling him, we will tell you every single penny that has been spent, but it's not in the interest of the taxpayer to tell you at the moment what the estimate is.
Perhaps in order that it may not be thought that I have misled the House, I said that it had been raised in July, last July, but it was in the course of supplementary. There was no substantive question on the Commonwealth Park project, but in the course of supplementaries involving the additional parking facilities of the Royal Voter Yacht Club and so on, the Honourable Member made a reference to the Commonwealth Park.
I find a statement by the Honourable Chief Minister difficult to understand. I mean, on the verge of being a ridiculous statement to make. Look, does he not accept that it is not only in the public interest and in the interest of the public purse for an opposition to scrutinise not only what a project has cost at the end of the project, but what it's costing, particularly for 6 months, when this project is due to be completed in 6 months' time? Because, of course, if what the Honourable Chief Minister is saying really is, well, the Honourable Minister for the Environment has an open check and can spend whatever he wants in relation to this particular project. And look, somebody listening to the debate to the exchange today, they will come to that conclusion because, quite frankly, I'm none the wiser as to whether, for example, there is a ceiling on this particular contract, or the Chief Minister, the Finance Minister, has said, hey, well, we're so environmentally friendly as a government, but you can spend whatever you want. Well, that is that the position? Well, quite frankly, we don't believe that that is in the public interest on the public press. The reality is that the analogy the Honourable Gentleman has provided with the 160 million in relation to the two housing projects announced, is an opposite analogy. I'll tell you why. Because presumably, he's also entered into contract with GJBS in relation to the main contractor in relation to this particular project. And you must know from those contracts how much this project is going to be, what the parameters are in terms of the cost. Unless I return back to the original point that I made, which is that effectively the finance minister, what he's doing is giving the Honourable the Minister for the Environment an open check. And that's certainly not in the best interest of the taxpayer or the public interest. Now, can you clarify that?
Look, Mr. Speaker, what it is very clear to me is that honourable members opposite, when, or those honourable members opposite that were in government, obviously were never trusted with the purposes, even in relation to their own department, by the then Chief Minister. Well, Mr. Speaker, look, let's be very clear. Whether he likes it or not, they lost the last election. We are the guardians of the public purse, and there is lot of questions about what we do with public money. I have told him the complete opposite of what he has now asked me, and he has chosen to ignore it. I have told him that not giving the estimate is in the interest of the taxpayer because it may enable us to bring the project in for less than the current estimate. Because there are aspects of the work to be done which may be able to be done for less, and because I entirely trust my ministers, in particular, I trust them with issues relating to taxpayers' money, otherwise I would not be in cabinet with them. I believe that they are able to deliver projects for the cost estimated or for less, for the quality that the taxpayer expects. For that reason, Mr. Speaker, whether they like it or not, they are going to have chapter and verse, compost. Bag by compost bag, daffodil, tulip, and eucalyptus, the exact cost of developing the Commonwealth Party. They will not be able to hide behind any suggestion that the government doesn't want to give the information. What they cannot do, Mr. Speaker, is put the government in a position where we are not able to save taxpayers' money that we might have been able to save them, because they want to insist in knowing estimate versus final cost. Well, Mr. Speaker, I'll tell them more. The government is prepared to commit itself to show them, when the project is completed, the final cost and the original estimate. And maybe that we go beyond the estimate, like most government projects have historically done, because those who provide services to government always see government as in profit. Or we may be able to save on the original estimate for each of the constituent parts of the party. But it is in the interest of the taxpayer, and we are the guardians of the public purse, that information be disclosed at the end of the program. Now, if they were genuinely here to try and assist the government in that particular respect, and I cannot imagine any opposition that might want to see a government have to spend more than they need to on a particular project, then they will accept that, Mr. Speaker. Otherwise, they will continue to make statements that the one of the honourable members has made when he started his intervention that suggested that what I had said had been on the verge of being a ridiculous statement. Well, Mr. Speaker, I've only been called ridiculous twice this week. One was by him, and the other time, which I consider a badge of honour, was in the front page of Abbotsay newspaper. I'm getting used to him and Abbotsay having the same views about the things that I said.
All these exchanges get out of hand. May I say, may I give the honourable member some guidance in general terms? My experience as a member of this House for over 20 years on both sides of the House is that government ministers very often used to make the point that the government is making, namely that they did not want to give an exact figure because it was commercially sensitive and that might give rise to tenders being higher than what it would have been. Invariably, however, members of the opposition did not accept that. They always asked for, vehemently, for estimates to be given. So it's nothing new, it's something that has happened over the years. Now, but I will say this, that when a new project is introduced into the estimate of expenditure, let us say in the Improvement and Development Fund, unless a purely token sum is provided, a realistic sum has to be provided as an alternative about the amount of money that the government would estimate that they're able to spend in that financial year. Of course, if the project were to go on beyond more than one financial year, they do not have to give the full amount as to what they would expect to spend in a subsequent year. That is in general terms, I think there are very parameters in which any experiences have to be taken.
I think that what distinguishes this from really other questions that have been asked in the past in relation to estimates is that here we have a project that has actually been allocated, the contract has been entered into by the admission of the minister, it's public knowledge, with GJBS, and it's 6 months from having been completed. So if the government doesn't have a pretty good idea of what this project is going to be is going to cost today, it will never have an idea until the final cost actually come out. And I note the Honourable Minister for the Environment nodding his head, that he was the one that stood up and basically said that he really doesn't know. But can I ask the Honourable Chief Minister this? Bear in mind the contracts that we entered into the GJBS, presumably for an amount. They can't be open-ended contracts. I don't think that the government would be mad enough to have not in relation, there may be open-ended in relation to some aspects of it, but in fact, as the overall contractor, there must be some sum in the contract dealing with how much GJBS is going to be paid as a minimum, for example. I'd be very surprised if it didn't. But can the Honourable Chief Minister provide this House a flavour of what aspect of the work on this particular site, the cost of which still needs to be determined? Because if you're talking about three banana trees, and yes, that is laughable. But if one is talking about substantial aspects of the work, and I'm asking what are the works? Give me a flavour of the work for which subcontractors, presumably, but it can't be GJBS, subcontractors of GJBS, still haven't tendered, or the government or GJBS still hasn't gone out to the market for prices in relation to those aspects of the work. Can you give me a flavour of that?
Because it was implicit in what I said, that the work still to be contracted are works which are substantial and will affect the price of the project, not banana trees, daffodils, tulips, or compost. Because those, to an extent, no, I didn't tell you that, Mr. Speaker. What I told you was that you would have the cost even of every daffodil and every tulip and every eucalyptus tree. And you would also have the cost of any banana tree that may be there as well. But no, I'm not going to give one. But what I'm saying is that in terms of costs still to be incurred and contracts still to be done, there is sufficient there for us to be concerned that could be reduced in some way, and therefore that's for that reason we don't want to share beyond the estimates already published, as Mr. Speaker has rightly indicated, what the potential cost is going to be beyond that. That, Mr. Speaker, in my view, is what they should have said at the end of the bond. So if they then want to come back to us when we have delivered the project and say this could have been delivered to us, even when we have delivered it, well done, we think this is a great project, fantastically delivered at this price. Great. I've already said that we will let them see the estimate at the time that we have also had a completion cost for the project. What could possibly be wrong with that if that delivers to them all of the information, but not immediately? It would be going to deliver a better deal for the taxpayer. But at the end of the day, we're all here to ensure that the taxpayer gets the best possible deal. They in their checking capacity, we in our spending capacity. That is what we have to ensure. And I think the mechanism that I'm proposing, Mr. Speaker, will ensure that they have all the information necessary to ask the question which they have been pursuing for some time now, but in the context of not endangering the potential cost to the taxpayer. All the information will be given. The estimate, the actual, and for the banana tree.
Speaker. I'm afraid he hasn't understood the point that the opposition is making in relation to it. You see, it's all very well for the opposition to be able to scrutinize, estimate, and actual costs after the event. But surely we must accept that it's also part of the opposition's job to scrutinize, estimate what it's costing now, and what savings can be made now when the government is managing, from a cost point of view, this project now, not after the event. But what he's suggesting really is that if this project comes in at £1 million more than it really should have been, whether we could criticize the government after the event, but we can't really do our job now in order to at least try and persuade the government to change course or to adopt a different policy that might actually save the taxpayers' money. And that can't be right. Now, you know, he hasn't answered my supplementary. And the reason why I ask this is this, because no, he hasn't. The reason why I ask it is this. When the Honourable Minister for the Environment stood up and he talked about, he said, the overall cost is not known. He spoke about trees, and he spoke about plants. Now, I would have thought that part of the cost of Commonwealth Park would be the minor part of the cost compared to the structural work that may be required in relation to, or the other types of work that may be required in relation to Commonwealth Park. Now, that's the reason why I'm asking, that what gives me a flavour of the type of work in respect of which the government, or DJBS in this particular case, the main contractor, still needs to go out to tender. Because if you get that, maybe the opposition would then be able to say, well, actually, this involves major structural work. It could cost, for example, £1 million. I can understand the force of the point that the Chief Minister makes. But if the Chief Minister says, well, we're talking about really trees, and maybe that the position may be different. Now, that's why I asked for a flavour of the type of work that still really need to go out to tender on behalf of people.
Mr. Speaker, I think your goal is really the position needs to listen more closely to the things that you say and the advice that you give the whole House. I said already in the first answer, the second answer that I gave him, the works are not strategies, banana trees and compost, they are substantial work. I didn't say structural, because there aren't that many structures there. There are few, but not many. Most parts don't involve structures, they involve infrastructure. Nothing being built, that's the whole point of a park. But Mr. Speaker, the way that the Honourable Gentleman is murmuring under his breath that structure doesn't mean structure. I suppose in the Alice in Wonderland world in which some of these questions appear to be posed, structure doesn't mean structure. Okay. Well, Mr. Speaker, let's be very clear. The reality is that most government projects come in over budget. The Honourable, the previous Chief Minister, now the backbencher for Peter Kapana, said in the context of the new airport, when he made the announcement of it, that the terminal was going to cost £24 million. He used to laugh, and he sometimes said a private joke during the course of the election campaign, but I turned up everywhere with the Chronicle, with the headline that had those £24 million on it. Because by then we knew, and the government had announced, that the cost of the project was actually going to be closer to £80 million. Right? Now, in the context of where we are today, with any project, we don't want to emulate that sort of overspending for the taxpayer. We want to get a better deal. I think it's right that somebody who, as a CEO of a particular entity, overspends by that ratio is judged by the shareholders. Well, that's what happened in that context, Mr. Speaker, in relation to the airport terminal. We are making huge efforts to deliver things for less than we think they might cost at the outside. We're trying to stay within our estimates, and we're trying to deliver within those estimates. And what they have got from us today is that they will share those estimates, Mr. Speaker. But rightly, when we are dealing with a government project, it will be set out in the estimate book, actually, so properly called for the purposes of this particular, I may call it, debate or not question. And then thereafter, there will be a balance to complete if the project goes on over a particular year, and there will be a final account.
Now, if you think that in that context, can't you just accept that I am telling him that the work left to be contracted are substantial, not just him? And by the way, Mr. Speaker, planting trees and growing large trees and etc. is a very expensive business if it is done right. But it is substantial work that needs to be done. And if he doesn't believe that the government is acting in bad faith, then can't he just accept that we are saying in good faith, this is in the interest of the taxpayer. I have volunteered that we are going to provide members of it with the final account and with the estimate. I'm just not prepared to do it today for one reason and one reason only. We think it's in the interest of the taxpayer to continue to try and reduce the cost to be incurred despite what the estimates we have been given are. And if you consider that, that is a good reason for wanting to proceed in a particular fashion, i.e. trying to ensure that the taxpayer gets the best value for money, the best bang for his buck. Can I just please ask you to accept that with the knowledge that the government has volunteered that all of that information will be given to them? He will know, Mr. Speaker, the projects that he was involved in went hugely over budget. Hugely. And we didn't say to him, halfway through the project, have you thought of not putting LED lights in the courtroom? Have you thought that perhaps you might want to choose slightly cheaper television, or that the secure dock might be made of less secure glass in order to try and keep the cost down? People, we allowed them to finish the project and then talk about the cost over the estimate of what the value was. I understand that in his case, it was a region of the £8 million estimated, perhaps £11 million total, roughly. But let me speak, I give him this. It's a better ratio than £24 million to £80 million. I have a supplementary on a different issue now, but relating to the question, specifically question 579 in relation to setbacks or difficulties. The Honourable Minister told the House that there have been no setbacks or difficulties other than the ones that are normally encountered in public services of this kind. Now, the Minister very quickly went on to say that it is not your average kind of project, and therefore, in that context, I'd be grateful for some more information from the Minister in relation to what those setbacks were or are. Speaker, I have no more information. I am not aware of any particular setback that would stand out. What could setback be? You're using a truck that could have a puncture. That's the sort of normal setback that I can have, but nothing that I could quantify or describe as anything major of any significance. I'm aware that the Honourable Member made some comments in the press during a press release that he issued in advance of asking the question. I suspect if it had been the other way around and we'd done that, we would have been questioned about whether we were using the correct procedure, but that's another point. I do not know what he was referring to then, and I do not know what he was referring to now. I'm advised that there have been no major setbacks.
Mr. Speaker, to take the Minister's point in relation to the questions being asked in advance of questions and similar concepts being filed for answers in this House, it is indeed a very critical point that was raised on a number of occasions as a result of answers being provided publicly to questions already filed in this House, and that has been more than well rehearsed in past sessions of this House. I refer the Minister to the answer he gave in saying that there had been nothing other than the normal variety of setbacks encountered on projects of this description. Now, it may assist the Minister to know that the information that I received, and again, the information may well have been mistaken, and if that's the case, that is simply the case. Information received from sources close to the project were that there were issues with the water table and the need to drain the site on a continuous or regular basis as a result of that. That was the issue that was brought to my attention, not by a random member of the public, but by a source close to the project. As I have already said,
If this information is in fact mistaken, I'm happy to be corrected, but I'd be grateful if the minister could provide some information in respect of that. Thank you.
Mr. Speaker, this has been several years ago, and I have been sitting in judgment as an magistrate, and the honourable member opposite has been sitting as an advocate. I would probably have dismissed his comments as hearsay, but if we're not sitting in court, I'm aware that the water table is an issue, or was an issue, but it was a predicted issue and not a setback, because we knew that the water table was of a certain depth, and that when foundations, for example, for the bandstand was being dug, there would be water coming in, and that was pumped out. That's not a setback, that is something that's predicted as part of the course of working closely with the table. That's not a setback.
And of course, Mr. Speaker, because I'm not in the court of law, I asked the question on the basis that I did, and I'm grateful for the reply by the minister.
Question.
Mr. Speaker, I move that the House now recess to 3 p.m. this afternoon.
The House will now recess to 3 p.m. this afternoon.